hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, and that means that there are less than, 5 hours and 58 minutes and change left in the arbitrary year designated 2013 of the common era as understood in the Western world in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. Such being the case, I will go ahead and wish a Happy New Year to friends further east of here in places like Germany. And Minsk. Hi, Minsk. And, by golly, all the way on around the planet, the new year is not particularly that new anymore for our friends in Australia, in China, and in Japan. This, of course, is the great big, oh my God, horn New Year's Eve Skype extrava Palooza or Lollapaganza. You pick. Either way is fine by me. We will have a darn fine time here in a little bit bringing the Skype gang on. We had a heck of a good time last year doing this. Thank you, Randy. Loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac, Bob. Thank you, Randy. Thank you very much. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is, of course, our home. That's where you'll find Entree into the chat room if you'd like to jump in. This is a great time. Any night is a great time. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. Also, you will find there access to the Listen Live button, which is handy for folks who are running Windows Media Player. If you like to listen in other manners, of course, over at WhiteRoseSociety.org, under the subdomain for this program, you will find a variety of different listening links. And, of course, if you're on some sort of portable iDevice, tablet device, smart device, then we highly recommend the apps from TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Radio. A reminder that any ads that you see in either of those apps do not in any wise come back to us. They support those apps and the lifestyles of the people who own those apps. So that does not we don't get paid. Which brings me, of course, to the third item that you can find at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, to wit, the PayPal button. We are in the home stretch toward the end of 2013, and of course, more particularly, the end of December. And that means that we're trying to finish up fundraising for this month. We find ourselves $430 behind. So 43 folks at $10 and the rest of the math that goes with it. And we would be in a much deeper hole were it not for the help of everyone who has contributed over the course of the month. And this is an appropriate time for me to note my sincere and profound thanks and the thanks of everybody who participates in this community to all of you over the course of not just this year, but all the years who have kept this going. It could not happen. It's not, no kidding. It could not happen without you. Boss Man Wayne and Agnes and I pretty quickly expended our financial contribution to getting this going and keeping it going years and years and years ago. And since then, this has been an exercise, an experiment in commercial-free, listener-driven conversation radio. And so, yeah, as the year rolls to its end, ignominious or not, I say on behalf of everyone to whom the horn matters and means something, I say thank you. Because remember, when you do contribute, you are doing so to make it possible for everybody who wants to listen themselves. There are people who have contributed over the years who have gone on, transitioned, shuffled off this mortal coil. There are people who have contributed who are not able to anymore, temporarily or permanently. There are people who have never been able to help keep this going, and yet have shared their ideas and their thoughts. And so those who contribute do not do so in a vacuum, but so that this community, which you all, far more than I, have created, can continue. Some congratulations are in order. First and foremost, a very happy birthday to a very special member of our community, Bill Miller, otherwise known as Mr. Stress, iconic Cleveland bluesman, will celebrate a birthday come midnight in the Eastern time zone. And also, happy anniversary wishes go out to Greg and Lynn, who on New Year's Day will have been married for 21 years. And I have just learned, and I will keep this anonymous, of an engagement, which has not been obviously made public yet, of an engagement. And so congratulations go out there as well, although I suspect the happy couple are out celebrating. Thought you'd like to have a Mr. Stress update. This provided to me by Thomas. Apparently, Bill will be going out for some New Year's action this evening in Akron. Here's the update that came from Thomas via Bill's friend Colin. Stopped to see Bill today. We took him to Value World to buy him two pairs of pants and two nice shirts at his request. Got him a nice pair of black dress pants and jeans and two nice shirts for a whopping total of $8.92. Colin is taking care of a lot of the otherwise onerous and irritating details of financial things and various things that he'll be needing when he sets up in his new digs once he's done with rehab. But he says, I'm planning on taking Bill with the band to Akron tonight for his birthday and our New Year's gig at the John S. Knight Center. It's an indoor gig. And I guess he's going to be picking up Bill in about 21 minutes. The gig will run from 9:15 to 11:30 this evening. So thank you. Thank you to Colin, and thank you to Thomas for keeping us all posted on all of this. It's much appreciated. So you see, there's a lot of celebrating to be done this evening, and I think we're going to have a good time of our own here in the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Duncan, longtime moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat group, will message me when he's pulled the gang together. And frankly, this being New Year's Eve, we don't have to talk news. We don't have to talk politics. We don't have to talk current events. Hell, we can sit around and tell jokes. or do just about anything. It's entirely up to y'all. And so we will see where that takes us. Just the same, until we do pull together all of the gang, sure, why not? Some stories, news accounts, things to cuss and discuss, things to outrage you, things to make you laugh, things to make you go, huh?
What, Edith?
Yeah. Hey, thanks very much, Lottie. Lottie getting us started this evening. We are now $405 away from finishing December to the good. So thanks, Lottie. Thanks for getting things started. No, a number of stories, and this one in particular has a certain relevance. For the time of year. I remind you that we celebrate New Year's the way we do. Well, let's do a little ancient history. The New Year used to begin in the Roman world, which was the world that gave birth to the modern world. The New Year was celebrated on March the 1st. March, of course, is named for the god of Mars, or the god Mars, the god of war. And March the 1st represented that time during which the citizen soldiers had gotten their crops in the field, they could then march off to conquer somebody on behalf of Rome. You know, a lot of cultures delineated their calendar based upon the growing seasons. The Romans considered the month of January, which was named after the two-faced god Janus, J-A-N-U-S, to be a mixed bag, hence naming the month after a god with two faces. You never know what you were going to get. And Italy is not, well, Italy's on roughly the same latitudinal line as the southern United States. Still gets cold. And so by March, you know, it's starting to turn and get a little bit decent. But no, they didn't mark the turning of the new year at January 1st. Hell no. No, we celebrate New Year's on January the 1st because this is the day. January 1st is the day. If you assume that the baby Yeshua was born on December the 25th, then January the 1st is the day he got his penis mutilated. Because, well, that culture was all about penis mutilation. I mean, you just, if you didn't mutilate your baby's penis on the eighth day, the big juvenile delinquent in the sky wouldn't think so well of it. Might even have him taken outside the city gates and stoned to death or something. Who knows? I mean, we're talking about a people who were baffled by wheelbarrows. Didn't understand why it rained or the fact that, you know, the earth traveled around the sun and not vice versa. So, yeah, New Year's Day, when you sit down to your corned beef and cabbage or your black-eyed peas or whatever it is that one eats on New Year's Day, we're trying to cover our bases here. We've got the corned beef is ready to go. The black-eyed peas are soaking. We are adding an element this year to, and we make Hoppin' John every year because I like rice too. This year, we're replacing the rice in the Hoppin' John with the last remainder of the rice that was gathered in the Kokagon Sloughs of northern Wisconsin and given to me while I was there last month. That will be the rice part of the Hoppin' John, and it will be wonderful. For some reason or not, well, I'll tell you why. The black-eyed peas thing is a largely southern thing in the United States. Corned beef and cabbage is kind of a up east thing and migratory with the wave of Irish immigrants moving across the United States. Because A, brisket is, was, but green, cabbage is green like money. So, yeah. But here in Appalachia, the tradition that I grew up with primarily was that one eats hog jowl. No, don't go ew. It's delicious. One eats hog jowl on New Year's Day for luck. Because if you think about the physicalness of a hog, the jowl is way up. You know, hogs are kind of low to the ground anyway, right? But the jowl is about as high on the hog as you can eat. And eating high on the hog is good eating. So hence the jowl. We'll take the skin from the jowl and we'll use it to season the black-eyed peas and the pot of collard greens that'll get going too. So we got the collard greens, green for money. We got the corned beef and cabbage going. We'll have Hop and John with black-eyed peas. We'll have wild rice. We'll have fried hog jowl. Well, this is resonating with Dr. John. He says, yes, let's get some food porn going. Wow, wild rice hopping, John? I cannot imagine how good that will be. I got my black-eyed peas and collards cooked. Tomorrow I'll bake mac and cheese. For tonight, I got eggplants under the broiler for Baba Ganoush, and I'm busy deviling eggs. And I bet nobody devils an egg like Dr. John does. Yeah, right, Randy. March, of course, at the Julian calendar, not the Gregorian calendar. Absolutely. Randy tells us that out Philly way, it's roast pork, sauerkraut, and mashed potatoes. Randy says, not too great on rainbow colors. But dang, that sounds good, too. So, I mean, are there other... I mean, what are the other... What are the other New Year's traditions, food-wise? Like I said, the collards and the cooked cabbage, I guess that would be post-Civil War, because that's when the money turned green. And that also represents the arrival of a great influx of Irish immigrants. Collards, of course, well, big Southern thing. Hell, I'd eat greens every day of my life if I could. I'd just love them. But feel free to share whatever your traditions are. And by the way, I mentioned Dr. John's note. He sent another note a few minutes ago. My good riddance to 2013 challenge. Bob, I'd like to offer a challenge tonight as 2013 lurches to its ignoble end. I'll match dollar for dollar the first $50 to come in tonight. Let's bury December's fundraising with a shovel, and then bury the shovel. Here, here, here. Put it so far away nobody can ever find it 1,000 years from now with a golden Marshall town. So, the next $50 that rolls in, Dr. John, will match. So that your 50 will turn into 100, and that'll be several spades of earth on the hole, and it will be much, much, much needed and appreciated. No, I said though that there was some relevance to all of this. This is the relevance. So tomorrow, whether we realize it or not. And I think it's a pretty good reason to find another day for New Year's myself. I like April 1st. Don't you? That'd be nice. Wait. Before I go any further. New Year's tradition from southern Arkansas and neighboring northern Louisiana from Fritz. Hog jowl, black-eyed peas, and greens. Turnip, collard, or you know, your choice. I went with collards. Fritz can tell you. Hog jowl's good eats. But we'd probably get away from the food porn real quick. whether we realize it or not, tomorrow we celebrate the penile mutilation of little baby Yeshua Bar Yosef. Oddly enough, there's not much in the Gospels, but some about that day. It no more likely happened on January 1st than the, you know, Christmas actually happened on, right, and we're not even going to fool with the history. Might not have happened at all, except in a generic sort of way. But that was a tradition that required, you know, penile mutilation. Because you wouldn't want the men having full nerve-ending stimuli. Who knows why? These myths usually have some sort of a grounding in reality, and we really don't know what it was. But it's still going on. And not just within that religious tradition, but in the wider American culture, not so much in other places. But the story takes us to Pittsburgh, one of my favorite mid-American cities. And it's the story of Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg. A story reported by KDKA of Pittsburgh, the only broadcast outlet east of Mississippi that has K for call letters. Never mind. Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg has a website in which he warns observant Jewish parents that a medical circumcision, usually performed in the hospital on the second or third day after birth, does not fulfill the requirements of a bris milah and is not considered valid according to Jewish law. That's a quote from his website. Bris milah? Isn't that what Freddie Mercury sings in Bohemian Rhapsody? Bris milah, we will not let it. Well, never mind. But I guess it don't count, and you can't grow the thing back and then hack at it some more. So Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg wanted people to understand that he was the guy to come to if you wanted to mutilate your child, your male child's genitals in honoring a covenant with a sky deity and keeping him happy. Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg works, among other places, at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill, Pennsylvania. Squirrel Hill's rather a nice neighborhood in Pittsburgh. And I guess the baby's parents bought into what Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg was selling and wanted to make sure that their little male baby had the right kind of penile mutilation. Only this one didn't go so good. No. Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg zigged when he should have zagged, or flounged with the knife, or whatever. But somehow or another, in 2013, the 21st century of the Common Era, he cut off the little baby's schmeckel. Cut it plumb off. This, in turn, required doctors at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh to engage there immediately in 8 hours of surgery and 6 blood transfusions on the newborn. The little fella stayed in the hospital for almost 2 months. And I can almost hear Daffy Duck saying, "Eh, it's a living." Yeah, accidents happen. This particular accident happened at Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill. And they say that they managed to reattach the little fellow's unit. You ever wonder if maybe something went wrong 2,000 years ago, and that's why Jesus never got married? I mean, the little guy in Squirrel Hill cannot possibly have been the first F-up of a bris in 3,000 years. David Llewellyn was consulted by KDKA. He's a lawyer. And he told KDKA in an interview that, and this is a quote, the average pediatric urologist probably spends about 20% of his or her time repairing children, and by children he means boys, who have been circumcised, and by that he means genitally mutilated. And this is a bit of a shocker to me. I had no idea. Lawyer Llewellyn said that there are no laws in the United States regulating religious circumcisions. He continued, there's virtually no regulation of this any place in the United States that I know of. I think the government probably should require some sort of training if this is going to be done. KDKA also reached out to Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg, who wants people to know that he's the guy who really knows how to do a bris that'll make God happy. And he said, I've been trained in this. This is a tragic accident. Now, it's not Wednesday, and we're not going to have a program tomorrow, being New Year's, so we won't have any Wednesday prayer meetings, so I thought we could just work this in this evening. When you're doing the religiously mandatory sexual organ mutilation of a child, and you wind up cutting the little guy's penis off, do you really get to say it was an accident? I mean, as a person who doesn't buy into this sort of thing, I'm just asking sort of, what, hermeneutically or epistemologically or hagiographically or, you know, one of those goofy Latin words that applies to religious bunk. Do you get to say, whoopsie? I can almost imagine Rabbi Mordecai Rosenberg as sort of a Michael Palin character, you know, with a sort of furtive, or maybe Marty Feldman, you know, with the eyes. Uh-oh. What hump? There's nothing funny about this. And we have no idea how the little guy will grow up. We don't even know if they finished the bris. No, you've done enough. But that did occur to me. Maybe this is why Jesus never got married, since we're celebrating his circumcision tomorrow by watching people run with pig skins all over the country. Oh, dear. But let's stay in Pennsylvania just for a minute. And we can get out of the religious business altogether. No, this is a story of, I don't know, what would you call it, the expanding criminalization of the ordinary? Anybody who's ever had a teenager knows that sometimes, and I don't know, is it sexist to say sometimes it's more difficult to get the boys out of bed and off to school than the girls? That's been our experience here. We've raised 3 girls and a boy, and it was always more difficult to get the boy motivated to get out the door and get on the bus. But anybody who's raised a teenager knows this can be challenging. Maybe they were up late studying. Oh, Mom, let me sleep. Dad! Well, by God, you don't do that around Pennsylvania State Trooper Ernest Boatwright. Thirteen-year-old boy, the son of his girlfriend, allegedly saw the young 13-year-old fella trying to stay abed instead of getting up and going to school. And in order to motivate... I know, sort this out for yourself, because it's not working for me. decided to motivate the 13-year-old to get up out of the bed and head off to school. By pepper spraying him in the face. When the police were called, my, that must have been embarrassing for them, the police were called on a policeman. But when the police were called, the young boy said, I knew I'd been pepper sprayed. I started to cough and burn, and I knew I was being pepper sprayed because, well, Trooper Ernest Boatwright has used pepper spray on me before. His lawyer, Matthew Zatko, says he's very much looking forward to the opportunity to defend himself. He has been criminally charged with endangering the welfare of a child and harassment. He's been suspended from protecting the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as a state trooper. He's been suspended without pay from that, pending the outcome of the proceedings. At the time of this incident, he was stationed at the New Stanton Barracks of the Pennsylvania State Police. And this isn't just some young ruffian state trooper. Trooper Ernest Boatwright has been on the Pennsylvania State Police since 1989. Good God! He's a 24-year trooper. Well, maybe they'll just offer him early retirement. Hopefully they won't let him keep his pepper spray. Jeeves. So, yeah. Strange things happen at the end of the year. ABC News in Tampa has the story of a man in Hernando County, Florida, who was arrested this past Thursday . You know, cops, the ones that are behaving themselves and trying to do a good job as opposed to pepper spraying 13-year-olds in the face, really, I've been told, hate to hear the burglary, okay, on the way. Robbery, on the way. Hostage taking, we'll be right there. Oh, they hate getting called out on the domestics. Well, Michael Mullady, or Mullady, M-U-L-L-A-D-Y, Michael Mullady got upset with his wife this past Thursday because she would not give him the family checkbook. That's when he started throwing things, because apparently someone in Michael Mullady's life had taught him in the course of his raisin that the appropriate response to being refused something is to begin throwing things. And this he then, at the tender age of 49 years old, proceeded to do. After he threw things, he said, "Give me the checkbook!" And she said, no, I won't. And that's when it got ugly. As Mrs. Mullady turned and walked away, her husband, who despaired of making his point by throwing things, grabbed a turkey neck from the kitchen counter, smacked her in the neck with the turkey neck, and then as she tried to retreat, chucked, I suppose, given the shape of a turkey neck, somewhat boomerang-like, chucked the turkey neck at her. Police arrived. He was arrested on charges of battery with a turkey neck and released on a $1,000 bond. He presently has against him a restraining order, ordering him to have no contact with his wife. I think, had I been the guy in the robe at the time, I would have also ordered him to have no contact with turkeys. Yeah. Just another day in America. Turkey neck. Aren't you glad to see 2013 on the way out? I am. We can start all over again. I mean, last year we got the government shut down. I wonder what we get from the Republican Party this year and their supporters. Anybody want to bet how Michael Mullady votes there in Hernando County, Florida? Because, I mean, I know this community we have here. And of all the people who write, and all the people who participate in the chat room and tweet at me and put things on my Facebook page, and, you know, I can say comfortably that I'm willing to warrant that none of these progressive, liberal-minded people have ever felt the urge, or God knows acted on it, to assault someone with a turkey neck. Or pepper spray someone in the face in anything but self-defense. Because there's just something about conduct like that that makes you think, this guy's a Republican voter. Dr. John out there deviling eggs. Hey, egg, yeah, you're puny, you're small, quit deviling me. You know where the idea of deviling comes from? The use of mustard. Because mustard is, I mean, anybody who's ever, you know, dipped the egg roll too deeply into the spicy mustard at the Chinese restaurant, yeah, it's hot. And so, since mustard is hot and hell is hot and the devil reigns in hell, when we devil something, we're adding mustard to it because we are making it like hell. Used to be, when we had the family tradition of doing a standing rib roast on Christmas, well, the first thing you do after the thing stood for a while and you know that you haven't just roasted it to death, is you cut off the rib bones of the standing rib of beef and you leave a good bit of meat on them. And what we would do the next day is make a sauce of horseradish and mustard and a little bit of cream, black pepper, some curry powder, whip it all together, and just paint those rib bones real good with that and run them under the broiler, and those were deviled rib bones. See how it works? Mm-hmm. Dr. John noting, assault with poultry. Good thing the cops intervened. Samson slew thousands with the jawbone of an ass. So imagine how this ass... Imagine how this case could have gone. What was she charged with? Possession of unlicensed giblets? Well, you know, it all comes in one package. So, I mean, he may have flung not just the turkey neck, but the liver and the gizzard and the heart. Oh, my God. You know what's missing from a story like that is the question of how many empty Coors Light cans or whatnot, or, you know, an empty bottle of Old Panther piss or two laying around the... Oh, wait a minute. Because while this may be... It's possible to take this the wrong way. I would prefer that this guy did this loaded out of his mind as opposed to stone cold sober. because it, you know, it's kind of like that Winston Churchill thing where it was, what was it, Lady Astor looked at him and said, "Sir Winston, you're drunk." He said, "Yes, madam, I am. And you are ugly. But tomorrow I shall be sober." Yeah, at least you can sober up and exhibit a little bit of remorse for throwing a turkey neck at your spouse, if she's in a forgiving mood. "Oh, honey, I was drunk." "Well, you better quit drinking." Yeah. Stone cold sober? Nah, you think maybe the marriage is on the rocks. Or the necks, as the case may be. Oh, yeah, it was about 31 degrees when I walked in a little bit ago. Yeah, night coming on. Yeah, definitely dark out there. Yep. Ah, somebody's heating up the coal furnace. I feel like I'm living next to my dad's old silicon furnace. Smell of this burning coal. Disgusting. People behaving badly. You remember, and Sandra mentioned it in our last conversation. Do you remember seeing, I never actually featured the story here on the program. I ran across it. Maybe you did too. The story of Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, of his Christmas card. It was a beautiful portrait of excess. The Christmas card that came out from the Jamie Dimon family this year was a photograph of Jamie Dimon's family. I mean, this is really from the Let Them Eat Cake department. It was a photograph of his family playing tennis indoors inside a fabulously appointed mansion living room. There was obviously some Photoshop going on, but there were tennis balls bouncing all over the place. His family, you know, some of them are huddled together, laughing and smiling and hugging. Another one's standing by herself, laughing. Another one is tossing a giant tennis ball in the air. Another one's swinging a racket. Tennis balls all over the place. Sort of a great big middle finger to people who don't have mansion living rooms big enough to play tennis in. Well, like father, like daughter. The daughter in question is Laura Dimon, who does not live in Michigan, does not live anywhere near Michigan, but somehow decided that she was an expert on Michigan, and in particular, Flint, Michigan. She wrote an article for an outfit called Policy Mike, P-O-L-I-C-Y-M-I-C, and I guess the way they operate there is that they the way the article reads is that Policy Mike uses a behavioral analyst to create viral headlines, and then once they've created the viral headline, a writer is assigned to come up with a story that matches it. I don't think we can call this journalism, do you? Well, that's what happened here with Laura Dimon, who knows nothing whatsoever about Flint, Michigan. But the folks at Policy Mike decided that they needed an article called "This is America's Most Apocalyptic Violent City, and You've Probably Never Heard of It." So rising to the challenge, Laura Dimon, daughter of privilege, declared that city to be Flint, Michigan. Laura Dimon then described Flint, Michigan as drowning, quote, in the hell that has become of much of America's rust belt. Gee, Laura, why don't you ask your daddy why? He might know. But never mind the blazing, brilliant, brilliantly blazing privilege that attends such a statement, and the fact that one knows nothing whatsoever about Flint, Michigan. Well, she accompanied the piece with a photograph that shows a tumbled down, ramshackle, beat up, wore out cityscape. The only thing is, it wasn't Flint, Michigan. It wasn't even remotely Flint, Michigan. Over at Reddit, a thread got going, sort of deconstructing Laura Diamond's attempt at non-journalism. And Reddit user SamIam25 realized something wasn't quite on the skinny. And SamIam25 said, "I thought I was hallucinating at first. This picture is not actually from Flint. I know this because I lived in the place pictured almost my entire life. It's a city in Israel called Ramla. I'm really confused as to why this picture is featured in the article, and I'm a little creeped out." Other folks, using the determinative powers of the interweb tubes, quickly confirmed that, yes, the photograph attending Laura Diamond's non-journalism was indeed Ramla, Israel. So, folks in Detroit, of which Flint is a suburb, got kind of pissed off and raised a little bit of a ruckus with Laura Diamond. And she was ultimately forced to replace the bogus photo of not Flint. Update, Laura Diamond has been is an actual writer for Policy Mike, but well, when your daddy's Jamie Dimon, you don't say you're making a living at it. People did not take well to her on the Twitters. Maybe you can wear one of our t-shirts for your next essay to make it seem like you visited the city. She tweeted out when she wrote the article, "This is an article I wrote about Flint. You might want to like and share. It'd mean a lot." The photo is of a brick building with no windows in it. And oh, Jesus. How can you expect Laura Diamond to know the difference between Ramla, Israel, and, you know, Flint, Michigan? That's like expecting her to know the difference between Saks and Bloomingdale's. Jesus. So they fixed the photo, but here's the fun part. When you're Jamie Dimon's daughter, you don't have to issue a correction. No corrections necessary. Thank you very much. If you've never been to the chat room, it's filling up nicely for this New Year's Eve extravapalooza, Lollapaganza. Anatole's joined us. Greg's in there. Jan R's there. Jug of Punch is there. Laborman. Hey, Laborman. Sergi's in there. Sparky. Lottie. I'm in there, of course. Stockton Larry's there. Todd's there. Truth Seeker is in there. Come on by and say howdy. You know how they say howdy in Knoxville, Tennessee? They put up a billboard. At I-640, where lots of people drive. Some folks decided to put up a sort of do-it-yourself billboard there. Oh, I bet you know where this is going. The banners were 30 inches tall by 123 feet long. They were hung over a Norfolk Southern Railroad bridge that crosses over I-640. And these things have been, it turns out, these things have been cropping up as far away as Oregon, as well as in Arkansas. And flyers with the slogan that you're about to hear were passed out at Eastern Kentucky University. It comes from something that is referred, that is called the mantra. And the mantra is an argument that some say came from former Ronnie Reagan administration appointee Bob Whitaker. The sign in Nashville, Knoxville, I'm sorry, Knoxville, big difference. The sign in Knoxville says anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. Yeah, I'm not in the predicting business. Not even a little bit. But I'm willing to hazard a guess, if not a wager, that based on things like this and the proliferation of them in places like Oregon and Arkansas and Eastern Kentucky University and wherever else, because, you know, if it's happened in those three places, odds are it's happened somewhere else. It just hasn't been reported. Based on things like this and Duck Doofus, I'm guessing the trending topic as we head into 2014, and please don't run away and hide, but one of the trending topics we're going to have to deal with in 2014 is the pushback of petulant white grievance. Anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. Here's what the mantra says. Asia for the Asians, Africa for the Africans, white countries for everybody. Everybody says there is this race problem. Everybody says this race problem will be solved when the third world pours into ever white country and only into white countries. The Netherlands and Belgium are just as crowded as Japan or Taiwan, but nobody says Japan or Taiwan will solve the race problem by bringing in millions of third worlders and, quote, assimilating, unquote, with them. Really, they spelled out quote and unquote. Everybody says the final solution to this, final solution, really? To this race problem, this is forever white country and only white countries to assimilate, i.e. intermarry, with all those non-whites. Oh, brother. What if I said there was this race problem would only be solved if hundreds of millions of non-blacks were brought into every black country and only into black countries? How long would it take anyone to realize I'm not talking about a race problem, I'm talking about the final solution to the black problem? You can almost hear Phil Robertson saying this, can't you? And how long would it take any sane black man to notice this, and what kind of psycho black man wouldn't object to this? This does sound like the Reagan administration. Remember, Ronnie Reagan famously got his presidential campaign going in Neshoba County, Mississippi, where some freedom riders were buried in an earthen dam. He also paid a stop to Tuscumbia, Alabama, just a scant feet away from the headquarters of the Klan. the mantra concludes. But if I tell that obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race, liberals and respectable conservatives agree that I'm a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews. By the way, Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews is one word. They say they are anti-racist. What they are is anti-white. Anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. Hello, Knoxville. Randy pointing out, Happy New Year in 5 minutes in London and Reykjavik. And I hear New Year's is a real big deal in Reykjavik, too. The only time of the year they get to use fireworks or something. Maybe we need a Reykjavik correspondent to confirm that. And thanks very much to James getting us started on Dr. John's Good Riddance to 2013 challenge. We now need only $35 to meet that challenge. That will be excellent. And we will be well along the way toward maybe, could we possibly finish December of 2013 not in a hole? Be a great way to start 2014 not in a hole and everything. Let's see if we can. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, or if you want to use traditional mail, just shoot me a note saying, hey, count me in on the challenge. So that's the first hour, and we will be pulling together, I hope, the Skype-a-palooza group, Lollapaganza. In short order. It is New Year's Eve. Here. Now. Nice note from, Jason. Bob, 45% of Mississippi Republicans want to ban interracial marriage. Well, apparently somebody's listening in Knoxville, taking them seriously. By the way, this from Fritz in Arkansas, going back to the story of Mr. Milady. Turkey neck dude was likely consuming large quantities of so-called beer known as Keystone. Wouldn't take the bet. We'll take a break and come back. Your calls on the Skype-a-palooza. We got four phone lines you can use. 304-658-3333 rings into all of them. One of them is on hold, so that's three lines remaining. And then, of course, if you want to jump in on the Skype side of the Lollapaganza, contact Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc on Skype and friend up with him, and you'll be part of the madness. New Year's Eve on the horn. New Year's Eve conversation radio on the way. I'm Bob Kincaid. probably a pretty easy choice, but trust me, and I've been holding this thread over people's heads for years. That, of course, New Year's Day, U2. I love the song. But I've been holding... Do not mess with me on New Year's Eve, or by God, I will play that god-awful Dan Fogelberg song. Okay? Are we square? Yeah, all right. Hey, great news. This is exciting. I went to the break and just bang, 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 it happened. Dr. John's challenge has been answered, and he has been seen and raised, as it were. Carol wrote in and said, "Hiya, Bob. Count me in on the challenge. Check for $100 in the mailbox now. Love you and this program. Happy New Year to you, your wonderful family, and all of the listeners and callers." That was followed in short order by a notification from Henry, 35, from Gary, who kicked in 150, from different Henry, who kicked in 50. So guess what just happened? We have crawled out of the hole. Unless my math is just way the heck off, we've crawled out of the hole. Or maybe we're within $5 or $10 of it. So that's just awesome. By the way, Randy, based on the, what was it, save yourselves, white people? No, anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. With regard to that story, Randy in PA says, apparently the white racists are superior because they're bigots. Oh, it's what separates them from the animals, right? Or separates the animal. Wait. No, it's what separates the humans from them. Oh, Jesus. And Dr. John pointed out, race problem in black countries? What the hell, Bob? Name a black country with a race problem. South Africa and Zimbabwe are all that come to mind. And hey, look, in both, the problem stems from generations of white people exploiting the local populace. Of course, there is a problem in what I'm guessing he means to be sub-Saharan Africa, but again, underdevelopment in Africa is a result of European interference for the past nearly 600 years. So I guess there is a race problem in black countries, and that problem is white people. Yeah, we could go back and we could have the discussion, but not tonight. It's the New Year's, the Lollapaganza, Extravapalooza. We could go back, and maybe we need to periodically just remind people that concepts of race did not exist in the ancient world, that it is a modern construct used to advance exploitative purposes on the part of the people with the money and the power and the guns. Hint, white folks. Reminds me of that story out of Ohio last week. Son, America doesn't need another black president. Guess we've been doing so damn well with the white ones, right? Oh, Jesus. No, let's get things going. We will go first to the phone lines and make sure everything's working over there. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Harry from Baltimore.
Well, hey, Harry. Welcome to the group. I'm glad you could join us. Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you. I actually called in early. In fact, as you know, I was on hold for quite a while, but I wanted to do that because I need to leave early, or somewhat early, and I wanted to basically at least say hello to the Horn family commune and maybe offer a few thoughts. So I thought I would call in right away.
Wonderful. Well, stand by. Let's find out who's on the second line. We've got two more lines open on the phone side, 304-658-3333. Hey, who have I got?
Hey, Bob. This is Dan.
Hey, Dan. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. I've been a long-time listener. I've contributed a couple of times, most recently last night.
Yeah, I was going to say you were a big help last night.
Well, you know what? I really enjoyed Darlene's narrative on what she went through in the state of Connecticut, the alleged blue state of Connecticut, with respect to her health care. This was a couple of weeks ago when she ran down her, you know, the obstacles that you've been talking about for the last week or so. And
yeah, I like to think of it as an odyssey.
Oh, man. Brutal. Brutal.
We just haven't quite, neither Darlene nor I have gotten to the island where we get turned into pigs yet.
It's so disgusting, and But I'll have more to say later on. But my neighbor is a very sweet lady about my age. I'm 60. I'm sandwiched right between you and Bill.
Okay.
I was born in the trailing days of the Truman administration, so I have a birthday coming up, and my neighbor is about my age, and she is from an Irish family, big Irish family, most of whom are Republicans. So I get the other side, and I had a disgusting conversation with one of her in-laws a couple of months ago, and he trotted out all the same repeated, tired, old Republican lines, the victimization, the anti-union nonsense. But you know, when you read about it, you hear about it, but when it's smacked in your face, it can knock you back a pace or two.
Yeah, I mean,
and
yeah,
you almost don't know how to respond to it. Like, is this guy joking or what?
You know, I've learned to just take it seriously. Dan, I was privy, well, not privy to, but standing next to a conversation, and it went like this earlier today. You know, my nephew went out and spent his grocery money. Well, we do that here too. My nephew went out and spent his Christmas money on a new .22 rifle. Did you know it is almost impossible to get .22 rifle? Can you imagine .22 rifle ammunition? You can't hardly get it anymore. I talked to him over at Walmart, and they said, "Well, we get it lots, but it just goes away so fast."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there, and because it's kind of like what you were experiencing. But in my mind, I've learned to go, and three, two,
yep,
one. Well, it's probably that Obama. You know, they figure since they can't take away our guns, they'll just take away our ammo.
Do we not know that?
And I just, bingo!
I know.
Behold the seal of Kant.
Yeah. Yep. I often think about that study from the University of Essex over in the U.K., where they determine that left-thinking brains and right-thinking brains are different, and the left-thinking brains have a larger
the big lizard brain,
cerebral cortex.
And the right brain,
the thinking part of the brain.
Yeah,
right.
and the right-wing brain has a big lizard brain.
You bet. The amygdala, the fear center.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Run!
Yeah, I know.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. The others are coming. They're coming for you.
Absolutely. Bob, good talking to you.
Well, stand by, Dan. We'll get a couple more folks on here. We'll bring the Skype group on, and we're going to have a whale of a time.
You bet we are.
All right, who have I got?
Is that me?
That's you.
Cool. I'll take it off speakerphone to talk to you.
Awesome. Hey, Kevin. And
Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year to you. And some of this funny-sounding, echoey thing will go away in a minute once the hybrid system learns what's going on. And one more phone line. Hey, welcome to the program. Welcome to New Year's Extravapalooza.
Hello.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And so now let us bring on, oh my God, what a Skype Skateer roll call we've got this evening. Good evening, Duncan.
Hello.
How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And as I noted in the see in the chat, this is an international Skype group tonight. We have Canada in the house.
And, hello.
Yeah, hello.
Steve.
Yeah, Steve. And
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And the Netherlands in the house.
Hi, Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So
Jeffrey's got some good white wine going.
Excellent, excellent. Jeffrey, Happy New Year now that it's already happened for you.
Yeah, that's right. That's some good white wine going on over here.
Lovely. In addition, we have Sal and Thomas and Jan and Larry's.
Happy New Year, Bob.
Happy New Year, Jan. And
Happy New Year, Bob.
And Happy New Year. To Roger as well. We got a good full crowd, but you know, plenty of room for more, right, Duncan?
Oh yeah, we had 22 people. I can go to 22.
So
Happy New Year, Bob.
Then I get maxed out. There was a couple people that couldn't join us tonight. Of course, Greg 2002, who runs the Malloy chat room, that you wished happy anniversary to at the beginning of the show. He's going out with his wife. And Texas Betsy had something to do at the synagogue tonight.
Yeah.
And then one of our youngest members of the Skype group that's in the Loy chat, Veronica, said she had people in. She's going out on the town tonight in Madison.
Hot diggity. That sounds like a good time. Of course, there's not a lot of town for me to go out on here, so I'm happy just to have the company. But we've got a bottle of incredibly cheap champagne chilling for Agnes. She likes hers with orange juice. And I've got a couple of incredibly cheap beers ready. So, you know, we'll be living large come midnight. But
I wanted to say Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you, Larry. Well, let's
hey everyone.
Hey, Sergi, how are you?
Cold. How about you?
Well, it's about 28 outside here, but we don't have a ferocious wind, and that makes all the difference in the world.
How are the feet?
What feet? I have no complaints about my feet. They're warm as toast. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I paid for the floor mat. Some people ought to kick in some money for the electricity. I don't want to hear Bob complaining about his cold feet the rest of the winter.
No. I will not say another word about my feet for the rest of the winter because my feet are happy. I didn't even know they made those things, Duncan. I mean, that's... No idea.
My mom used to use one at her desk.
Well, it's amazing. You just sit there and everything's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm comfortable, just sock feet.
That's what they're made for.
It's perfect. Just absolutely magnificent. Everything is different now. Because, I mean, all kidding aside, it was getting kind of uncomfortable. You know, because when your feet get cold enough, they begin to feel like they're burning. And then you just stop feeling altogether. And in my...
A lot of nerves going down there.
Yeah, well, in my new existence as a diabetic person, I kind of worry about things like not feeling my feet.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. And let me put a couple of shout-outs. Luda, our buddy Luda, just said, hope this helps, homie. Tonight will be 1 year since I started listening to the horn, so I'll mark it with a contribution. And it does help. It does help indeed. And again, thank you to Thomas as well. We're out of the hole, which is amazing.
That's excellent.
You know, Bob, it's really scary. You told me you told the whole group that you were a new diabetic, and that's really scary.
Well, I'm not that new. It's been about it's been over a year now. Maybe 2 years. But I don't make a lot of noise about it. I take a couple of pills every day that are mercifully $4 a prescription, so we're managing it thus far. And I know I'll get hate mail for admitting this, but I still enjoy the occasional pop, and I found something amazing today because we know I can't tolerate caffeine, right? I found Coke Zero caffeine-free, and it's just wonderful. I don't want to drink a lot of it because that stuff apparently eats your brain, but, you know, I love water, but once in a while, just a little, you know, something else.
Yeah, I'm speaking of Coke Zero, that's a funny thing because, you know, I love regular Coca-Cola, but there's something about Coke Zero that really tastes good to me.
Well, it tastes
and
good.
I'm not sure. Oh, sorry?
Yeah, it tastes just like Coke to me.
And, you know, I'm not sure if I've mentioned this, you know, live on the show in this group before, but, you know, I've been interning at the Tarrant County Democratic Party headquarters for about a few months now, and, you know, there's this fridge they keep in the office kitchen, right? It's like there's a recurring joke up at the office that you better lock down the Coke Zero before Sergi gets there at noon.
Yeah, this stuff tastes better than Diet Coke. God knows it tastes better than Tab, better than Diet Pepsi, and there's no caffeine in it, which means that I don't go... You know, and feel like my heart's about to explode.
Well, Bob,
do they still make care?
If any consolation, I know a 97-year-old diabetic who's constantly trying to fall off the wagon and eat things that she shouldn't. So,
well, yeah, and
I'm 97, so I think you can make it that far.
Right. I hope so. I hope so. I really, you know, I'd like to see a whole bunch of what's coming at us for good, bad, or indifferent.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, yeah, 97 would be interesting. I'd like to see what 2050, 2060 looks like.
Yeah, well, me too. Yeah. Well, Bob, actually, you know, one of the reasons I came on here, although this is not rehearsed at all and certainly not a canned testimonial for you, as I hope you will attest, I'm not going to be able to stay long past, you know, maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock, but I just wanted to say something about the Horn family and about your program, if I might, and I apologize.
Please do.
I apologize if this starts to sound maudlin and sentimental because,
Oh, I've got some strings we can cue up behind you if you want.
Yeah, well,
maybe a tinny whorehouse piano or something like that. Yeah.
It may be, but this is sort of spontaneous. It came to me about an hour ago, and I just feel like I should at least say part of it. I remember well when, what was it, September 23rd, when you announced that you might need to close down the program because of the financing was becoming too difficult for you.
That sounds about right.
Was that about September 23rd? Yeah. And I myself, I was listening that night. I don't know if I was live or listening to the podcast, but of course I was horrified and deeply distressed by that. But I just want to say, and not everybody in the Horn family knows this, but, you know, I've been a member, I guess I would say now, a listener, member of the Horn family commune for about 20 months, but at the end of 2012, I literally was basically compelled and felt forced to make a move from Washington, D.C., where I'd lived for more than 20 years, to the city of Baltimore. And did that for a number of reasons, including the much lower cost of living here, but also for other positive reasons. But whatever it was, that move was quite disruptive to me. And in fact, I really wasn't able to listen live to the Horn for about 4 or 5 months after that because of the housing situation I first sort of dropped into, which turned out to be a house-sitting job overseen by an absentee owner who, in fact, turned out to have very serious mental health problems, which I only discovered. I sort of sensed it after a few months, but it was eventually confirmed to me by, oddly enough, her brother, who turns out to be an eminent professor of psychology in somewhere in the Northeast in college. Very eminent college in the Northeast. Anyway, but I want to say that during all that time, and particularly when I was listening to my podcast and going through trying to find another place to live because this woman was becoming increasingly mentally ill, it was really the Horn family that I knew that I was always looking forward to, even the podcast, and they really sort of kept me going. And I realize that for some people that may seem, you know, overly melodramatic, but I would add to that that although I am not a biological orphan or a criminal justice system type orphan like our dear friend and wonderful Princeton student Cassie, I myself at around at least from age 16 realized that I would always probably be in a sort of emotional orphan because I realized that I had a very strange and dysfunctional family and particularly very odd parents who seemed to just hate me for not being the kind of son that they wanted. And although I have, over the years, as I've grown into an adult, dealt with that better and better over time and over the last few decades, the fact is that indeed, one in the back of one's mind or heart is always, in a sense, looking for a family or a family grouping or commune or whatever that one can, in fact, feel a part of. And this also has to do with the fact that politically my values and my moral values have always been also quite different from the other members of my family of origin. And so that was sort of a double whammy for me. And I want to say about 20 months ago when sort of accidentally I found out about your program and the fact that you're broadcasting live on the Internet, every weekday night. I just realized after a while that I had stumbled upon a real treasure, a real box of gold. And, you know, it just, and I don't know other people's, you know, I'm not a veteran horn person, so I don't know a lot about other veteran horn family commune members, but I know that for me, and even though this is only purely on the internet, and this has really been a amazingly uplifting experience for me to become over time a member of the Horn Family Commune. And I think, and certainly there are some just an amazing number of wonderful people. I think somebody said the other night something about how, I forget what the quote was, that all of us had somehow been, were in a certain container and they had dumped us all out and we ended up at the Horn. But, and so I have a deep respect for the, you know, everyone's, views and things they say and the diversity of the insights, et cetera, is just amazing. But also, Bob, I just find that in any kind of organization or institution or whatever you want to call it, group that coheres, there's usually a leader whose organizational or kind of cultural values infuse that group with something very healthy and very empowering. And I just felt the need to say that, Bob, that I somehow or another, despite your diabetes, other health problems, and you're still wrestling with the West Virginia State Healthcare Insurance Exchange, that
I don't know if I'm still wrestling, Harry.
I think
the referee's beaten it to at least a two count on the mat so far.
Well, all right, but you're gonna get up and appeal, and you know, as you know, I myself, even in Maryland, have had trouble for several weeks. But in any case, I just want to say that I think that I wouldn't want to say leadership, but your hospitality, your in a sense, hosting this kind of program to me has just been more than invaluable. It's really been just a sort of a lifesaver. And even more so, when I had to make this, frankly, abrupt and somewhat involuntary, move at the end of December 2012 to Baltimore. And, I just want to say how much I appreciate both you and really everyone in the Horn family, because there seems to be this kind of very tolerant and extremely empathetic culture that is just a far healthier than anything I ever encountered in my own family or even in other institutions that I was involved in as I was growing up, such as schools and universities.
Well, that is incredibly kind and generous of thought and spirit, Harry. And the fact of the matter is, you know, there are no degrees of initiation for membership in the Horn Family Commune. Nobody has to ride a goat or chase a grease pig or anything like that. So. No, I think I think you're a member in good standing with all the rights and privileges appurtenant thereunto. Wow, isn't it funny how the language stays with you?
I'm sorry.
Isn't it funny how the language stays with you? All those rights and appurtenances and heirs and assigns forever, amen.
Right.
And
right, but no, I was talking about the fact that indeed that there are people who've been. You know, members or veteran listeners for many, many more years than I have. I mean, I know this program in its present form is going more than 8 years, and I really only started listening about, you know, a year and a half ago. So I just wanted to pay my respects to those people who have been involved and supporting you for much longer than I have. But indeed, the entire Horn Family Commune, or whatever we are calling it these days, is really something that I have not only been felt supported by even when I was just listening to podcasts, but it just has made a sort of most spiritual difference in my life to know that there's this group of people out there, who, and many of whom I may never meet in person, but who all, in a sense, are coalescing around a collection of, I don't know, of values and social policy ideals and other things that certainly are in accord with my own values and social policy leanings and ideas. And it's just, I just went on, you know, on this New Year's Eve, I just wanted to just sort of, in a sense, salute you and salute the horn and the way that this community has held together. And, you know, I certainly, and I was listening the night that our dear friend, as I call him, the Studs Terkel of Cleveland, Bill Press, seemed to be having some health problems in the way that everyone kind of pitched in to make sure that he would be helped. And I've never heard anything like that. Certainly, I've never heard anything like that in any mainstream media program and even on any liberal program, progressive program that's not mainstream. So.
Well, you know, it. You mentioned Mr. Stress, our buddy Bill.
Yeah.
I'm sure he would love to be involved in this conversation this evening. But I am absolutely ecstatic at the idea that he's going to a gig tonight.
Well, that's even better. But I just.
Yeah. Well, and the reason I mentioned that is that when I just heard about it, Thomas Jug of Punch in the chat room said. Mr. Stress has left the building. He's on his way to Akron now.
Oh my God!
And
well, that's,
and I've just got this vision of him being introduced there at the gig to some sort of rousing applause, and I hope it works. I hope he has a big old smile on his face as he welcomes in his 71st birthday tonight.
That's right. His birthday is, well, I think it's, isn't it New Year's Day?
Yeah. He was the first baby in Cleveland some 71 years ago.
Yeah, no, because I remember reading a year ago that it was the 70th, yeah. But in any case, well, no, that's thrilling, and I'm just thrilled to death. But that, to me, is just, you know, sort of one example of the way that this foreign, program, quote, dash, or slash family, slash commune, is just so extraordinary, if not unique, in this culture right now. And although I know, Bob, you know, you grew up in the South, and I grew up in, you know, urban Northeast, I just, and I worry that that might, you know, how that would work out, but I must say that I'm just so honored to be, a part of this and to, have talked with you both, on the air and, occasionally through email, and it just means the world to me.
Well, your emails have been really trenchant and,
very kind to say so.
Well, no, they really are, and deep observations, and I've gotten some wonderful reading recommendations from you. And you, along with everybody else involved in the Horn, and it's the ideas and the communication and the conversation that comes first.
Absolutely.
Who communicate all these things enrich my life in ways that I can never fully express, but by the same token, it's creating this universe of communication and ideas that I think really makes it so special, and
yes,
you're a very big part of that.
Well,
Bob, I wanted to say that
stand by, Larry, because Harry's got to get out of here pretty quick.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
I apologize.
I'm sorry, Larry. No, hi, Larry. How are you?
Bye, Harry.
Let me just say one or two things. First of all, Bob, I mean, you're. The most amazing thing, I suppose, from my point of view, is the fact that you continue to, in a sense, do this really almost every single night on a shoestring. And, you know, and of course that September 23rd announcement, really, at least to me, sent, you know, shockwaves through my life and body, because I felt so terrible that we come to that. And I just hope, and I'm delighted by the people who just donated, you know, during the break, during that wonderful U2 song, and I, you know, as I've said myself, I in fact am in financial difficulty myself, and have not been able to donate. But I'm so grateful to those who have been able to and who have donated. And I guess, you know, I don't want to be presumptuous and thank them, but I'm just grateful for them. And if I could just say one or two things, or one thing about the Mordecai Rosenberg.
Yes, please.
And the circumcision now, as Bob is, you know, I am Jewish, and I'm a Reformed Jew, and I must tell you, geez, about 10 years ago, friends of mine in suburban D.C., even though they're quite reformed and quite in the sense of, in other words, not very religious, particularly ritualistically, were somehow convinced that their son should go through a bris, which, as I hope most people know, means the, that's the ritual where the circumcision is done, and it's usually a big sort of family occasion.
Family party, get together, lots
right.
of fun,
and fact,
joyous.
And the word
Seinfeld.
I didn't realize there'd been a cycle. But, you know, and of course it's funny because it's done not in a hospital setting or even in an urgent care center, but it's done in somebody's home, living room. And in this case, although, as I said, my friends, I think, sort of felt pressured into it, and although it seemed to go okay, and certainly the Mohel, which is the person, you know, does the cutting, didn't, like in the case you mentioned, cut off the organ involved. The fact is that somehow he botched it, and I, several years later, in fact, someone had to do surgery on this young man's
unit
appendage. Yes, and so when you mentioned the pediatric urologist who said he spent 20% of his time fixing these things, I can well understand that.
You know,
and
I mean,
I just don't understand anymore. How they can allow, as you, and you pointed out, these people who, we don't know how, in a sense, what their training is, or what kind of, you know, experience they got, what kind of mentoring they get in doing these things.
Right, and, I mean, what if there was a tradition that required, amateur appendectomy?
Exactly, I mean, it's unbelievable, yeah, in Judaism, right, you had, you know, your special rabbi for appendectomy, I mean, it would, I'm sorry, I'm saying that I'm Jewish, and I can say, I guess I can say it more than other people. I think it's ridiculous.
Well, I'm sure that once this hits the podcast, I will get pushback.
It doesn't matter. I don't care. I'm Jewish too, and I've been to a number of brises, and I found all of them to be just very, very difficult to watch because I say to myself, certain Mohels have been doing this for years, and some of them are rabbis, some of them aren't. The fact is...
Sometimes teeth are involved.
What's that?
Sometimes teeth are involved.
Oh,
yeah.
That's hard to believe.
And not only that, I got to say, you know, in fact, I now live in Baltimore, and maybe people haven't read about this or remember this. There used to be in Baltimore a famous professor of sexuality and, sex organs named John Money. And John Money, for a while in the 70s, was kind of a god of medical sexuality in the world of the field of medicine. And that was, unfortunately, until he basically was involved in a situation where, indeed, a male child, organ or appendage, was damaged. And John Money, being at that time at the peak of his career and probably much too arrogant for his own good, even though he was known as the, you know, expert on human sexuality in the medical field, he advised the parents basically, and this has been recorded in a book called John Colapinto, who was a great journalist, I forget the name of the book, but basically the parents were persuaded to make the child basically into a girl. Because of what John Money had botched.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, when this came out, indeed, John Money's, you know, reputation in the field of medicine and whatever, sexual medicine, of course, took a dive, and he is retired now. I don't know if he's still alive. I think he may be dead. But the fact is, even he, you know, and this was not a religious thing. This was just something done at a Johns Hopkins clinic or hospital. But, you know, it just goes to show that you shouldn't be fooling around with these things because in this book by John Colapinto, who is really a wonderful medical journalist, it showed really how that young man really went through hell because he never...
Well, yeah, and Harry, I'm trying to come at it from the 21st century point of view, and that is that we should not be, male or female,
right.
We should not be mutilating anyone's genitals
right.
without their, you know, I mean, Jesus, you have to have the express written consent of the commissioner of Major League Baseball to rerun a goddamn 6-4-3 double play on TV.
Yeah, I agree.
Can we please have some express written consent from children before their genitals are hacked on?
Yeah, I really think that, frankly, the religious verses should be, frankly, prohibited. You know, if you want to get it done in a hospital, which, in fact, has been done in hospitals for years, just, you know, mostly as sort of a public health thing, or, you know, that's fine. But and I'm saying this as a Jewish person, I have no tolerance for these private verses, and I think it's just, frankly, to me, it's almost as bad as these people, frankly, and sometimes this is good, sometimes this is bad. I'm sure some people will criticize me about this, but, you know, people want to have a birth at home. Now, okay, under certain circumstances, that can be done well, but I also know someone who I knew in Boston in the late 1970s who wanted to do that, and the baby strangled on the umbilical cord, that's right.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to say that this gentleman, the father whom I worked with, believe me, he was in grief for years. I mean,
yeah.
So, you know.
Well, I personally, welcome to the TMI part of the Horn extravapalooza. I was a breech.
No, I'm going to stop.
No, I'm talking about me. I was a breech. And
okay.
Had that been a home birth, I would not be in existence. So, you know.
Well, I don't know what to say, but, you know, on the other hand...
Well, my family always said that it was in my nature that I had to come out feet first so I could take my first bow.
The only thing I would say is that, and I know some people think that, you know, 21st century hospitals are sterile, but the fact is we're also in the 21st century in terms of, you know...
Yeah, we've got 21st century bugs.
Bugs, and also we have 21st century... at least some of the time, medical training, and I would prefer that myself.
Here, here. Well, Harry, wherever you're going and whatever you're doing for this New Year's Eve, I wish you the very best in doing it. And I thank you so much for the kind words.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I will take my leave so somebody else can get on this line, but I just wanted to wish a very happy New Year to all of the Horn family and all the staff group tonight. And
happy New Year!
Oh, thank
you. Back at you, Harry.
All right.
Happy New Year.
You take care, Harry, and we will talk soon.
Well, all of you guys are just great, and I love you all. Thanks so much.
Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Wow, that was pretty intense. Harry communicates very, very well, and his emails are always a pleasure to share with you guys. And like I said, the stuff he sends along for me to go and read, wow. Just a tremendous mind out there. And, you know, I used to joke when Agnes was back here producing the program, I said that I used to say when people would start talking about, you know, what the program means to them, I'd tell people that they had to stop because Agnes was waving the C-clamp at me, which she would then put on my head to make it decrease back to normal size from the fact that it was, you know, it was getting a swollen head. But it, you know, that kind of sincerity and that kind of candor is good because it reminds us that there is, you know, my God, you know, what a community we have here. Hey Jim, I wanted to jump back to you for a second just to answer that question that we didn't. Yes, TAB still exists.
Oh God,
and it still sucks.
I wish it didn't. That's got to be the nastiest.
Is it just sold in certain areas of the country?
That's got to be the nastiest thing that ever was put in a bottle.
It's sold in Fayetteville, West Virginia. I can tell you that much, Duncan.
Well, I'm not surprised about that.
And the only salvation for it is a wedge of lemon. I mean, that is the only hope.
I had a boss who used to drink it warm.
Oh, God, Jan.
I know, right out of his car when he was set on the road.
I remember when social studies teacher in the sixth grade, this was before, this was circa 2003-04. I haven't seen TAB in North Texas in any grocery store since 05. So this was right before TAB pretty much went away in this region. My sixth grade social studies teacher kept a refrigerator in her classroom that had nothing but cans of TAB. Every time she opened, there was a minimum of 20 cans up in that little commercial fridge.
Well, I associate Tab with glossy magazine print ads of women wearing polyester and big floppy hats in really, you know, that sort of... Remember that refrigerator green color they called avocado? Remember how popular it was in, like, 1973 in certain
yes.
forms of Dacron?
Call it baby puke green.
Well, there's that, too. I was trying not to ruin the food porn segment of the program, Sergi.
What do you mean, government green?
No. Remember that? No, Jim, come on. That god-awful...
Avocado
green. Yeah, avocado green, that god-awful the color that they made refrigerators and stoves in.
That's called government green, too.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yeah, because and that's differentiated, of course, from hospital green, which is another shade of hateful. But yeah, right. And in the chat room, Lottie's saying, and guys wearing bell bottoms. Yeah, the great big elephant in your belt. Yeah, that's the Tab culture. I think
we got a wash machine that's avocado green.
Well, and that was the other thing. That was back when they built appliances that were meant to last a while.
It's still going. It makes a lot of racket.
Yeah.
What was the era when they, because I've seen bathrooms in houses that haven't been updated in decades here in Fort Worth. I've seen bathrooms that are avocado green, you know, the all the porcelain, the bathtub, the toilet,
yeah,
the sink.
Yeah, it's
is
the same.
From the same era?
Yeah, that's it.
It's like in the 60s and 70s when they did that.
Yeah, late 60s, early 70s, and its counterpoint was something that they referred to as goldenrod. Because my family's bathroom was goldenrod.
Oh, God.
My dad would take these spells where he would decide to be domestically useful. And one of them involved him deciding that, by God, he'd never had wallpaper, and he was going to wallpaper the bathroom. And he and my mother somehow or another agreed on this sort of nightmarish, paisley, small print, goldenrod wallpaper for the bathroom, and my father mixed up the wallpaper paste, and well, I think there was a run to the Tennessee state line and a case of beer involved, and
I'm sure
I never there were occasions sort of like what Gene Shepherd says about his dad in A Christmas Story, where you were pretty sure that the vulgarities and swearing involved were still orbiting in outer space. And the day of the living goldenrod wallpaper was ours.
You know, thank God for stainless steel.
Yeah, isn't it ever so much nicer?
And granite, really. I mean, some of the stuff they came up with to decorate bathrooms and kitchens back in those days. Oh, Lord. You didn't know what you were in.
And it was, well, and that was a direct outgrowth of the fact that prior to that, everything came in, you know, three colors, white, or vaguely off-white.
It's called, you know, appliance white.
Yeah, I had a friend who, my favorite color is navy, but he took a small bathroom and painted that thing navy and actually did it, and I had to use it. He said, well, what do you think of a bathroom? And I said, well, if you like sitting inside of a bottle of Noxzema, it's great.
Jesus. That's like a friend of mine built a new house, and I was sure that they decided to paint the kitchen red. And I said, come on, man, there's going to be a homicide in here. You can't paint this kitchen this color.
nothing says bringing the family to the dinner table like blood red walls.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Pompeian red or something like that. So, you know, there are tasteful shades of red. It doesn't have to be firehouse. I mean, you know, it can be, you know, certain colors can, you know.
Well, this was Bullfighter's cape red.
Well, that's a little much. But, I mean, you know, Pompeian red or something like that, or, I mean, certain colors can brighten your day. And, you know, it's said that, like, colors of rooms add to a person's mood and that type of thing. And I believe that's true. Just like, you know, for example, the absence of light can cause SAD or seasonal affective disorder. Room colors can be very, very important to a person's mood, whether they're going to brighten you up a little bit or they're gonna bring you down.
Oh yeah, I forget where it is, but there's a There's some football team whose visiting locker room is painted pink.
Is it pink or is it pink?
No, it depends on where the team is, and I cannot answer that question. Jim, that's like the difference between naked and naked.
Well, that's the reason I said that. I mean, you know, I have seen pink, and I've seen it artfully used, and then I've seen what we call pink, and oh my God, it was like being inside of a bottle of Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, speaking of Pepto-Bismol pink, there is an online video game that I play called APB, and one of my friends who I play that game with, Scout, he's listening right now, so a shout out to him.
Hey, Scout.
Basically, I like to troll others in that game and kind of freak them out. So I opted for my main in-game vehicle to be a minivan with the gargantuan unnecessary spoiler on the back, and I made it Pepto-Bismol pink.
and see, just so you'll know, what the goldenrod wallpaper covered up was pink.
Oh yeah, from those. Yeah, wasn't that like the 50s pink?
Well, this house was built in 1959, the one that I grew up in, and it had baby blue tile about 2/3 of the way up the wall, and then just painted sheetrock in. And Jim's right, pink. And Fritz from Arkansas just chimed in and said, "Yeah, pink." So yeah, you touched a nerve. And Jack in Shreveport says, under the subject line, ha 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 ha, goldenrod. I was wondering if I was thinking the right word, and then you mentioned it. After the avocado color was mentioned, I thought of the other one too. I think the counterpoint of puke green was snot yellow. Yum, yum, under tools of leather.
God, this is Stacey wanted to go to the store and hunt for paint chips.
or go to an old house and munch on some. What, Sparky?
Can I give a shout out to Jack? Get your Skype on, man.
Here, here.
He's a part of the Horn Molloy Skype group on Friday nights a lot of times.
And let me extend some more thanks. Thank you very much to James in Kentucky, and to Diane in Kansas. Stan, she signs Diane in Kansas. Stan, so we're not being mean. It looks like we're gonna finish December ahead of the game, and that's just wonderful. That's magnificent.
As it should be.
Yeah.
Bob, I just wanted to chime in.
Yeah, Larry.
I appreciated Harry's comments, and I feel very much the way that he does about the nature of this, of the how well, you know, what this Horn chat group and also the Molloy chat group means to me. And I wanted to say that you do an awful lot of good, Bob, and so do people in this chat group. And you know, it would be good if Ben Birch would save a copy of this program.
Oh, it's archived every night, Larry.
Yeah, be able to hear that, because people need to know that the Kincaid Show is out there, and that the Bill O'Brien Show is out there, and
thanks so much for mentioning. Thanks so much for mentioning Dr. Bill, Larry. I should probably mention that he was. I am a bad person. Bob, he just spent the last several days up in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if he could have gotten around, he would have loved to have met Lottie and some of the other folks up that way. But he got on the train in Boston this morning and was headed home. And you know, it's a lovely ride from Boston to D.C. on Amtrak. But after you get outside of Washington and you start heading for West by God, Jesus God, you might as well be in a covered wagon.
Oh boy,
was it tracks?
What
bad?
Have we got, Bob? Rough tracks and
what it is is the Northeast Corridor. Amtrak runs on its own track. I mean, if you can imagine the brilliant rail systems of, say, Asia or Europe, Imagine if you had heavily laden coal freight cars running over those day after day after day, year after year.
Beating them up.
Yeah, they'd be beating all to hell. Well, that's the tracks that Amtrak runs on outside of the Northeast Corridor, at least in many places. And so the way it's set up, if an Amtrak train gets 1 second behind schedule, it has to lay over and give right-of-way to these freighters. And the Amtrak trains have been beaten all to hell by riding on these rough roads. I mean, I think I sat for 2 hours on a siding somewhere in the wilds of Augusta County, Virginia once, just waiting for freight trains to pass.
Do they have a bar car?
Yeah. You know, same thing. Mini bottles, just like an airplane.
Well, I hope you availed yourself of it.
No, I didn't. Because this is just, you know, my filthy habit. I can't, if I'm going to drink, I got to smoke. And because it just drives me.
So the industrialists' right of way supersedes the public's need to get from point A to B.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And in this neck of the woods, in particular, the coal industries need to move coal.
Sure.
By the way, Bob, you were mentioning the social construction of race earlier, and I was just learning about that whole concept in a sociology of race and ethnic relations course this past semester, which I did fairly well in. And it is true, based upon that theory, that race was developed as a concept so that the planters could justify slavery, and that's how.
It's even different from although you know this is strictly academic, it is even different from the understanding of slavery that we have out of the ancient world. You know, in the ancient world, people would sell themselves into slavery because they could make more money doing it, or because they had horrible debts, and then they could buy their way back out. But, you know, slavery is still human bondage, but nothing quite like slavery as it was propounded into the New World had ever before been seen. And by the way, along those lines, anybody who has not seen, it's a 6.5-hour documentary, I may have mentioned it a couple of nights ago, it's there for the viewing on YouTube. It's simply called 500 Nations. And it is a 6.5-hour documentary hosted by the odious Kevin Costner, who you just kind of have to overlook. And you have to sort of listen with your ears wide open to know when you're being bullshitted. But it's a 6.5-hour documentary of the world that existed in the Western Hemisphere before the arrival of white Europeans. And it's brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. They did a lot of magnificent CGI work. Tried to get actual people who could... I mean, for instance, they've got a Mexican anthropologist who is translated in the film. Every word he says is in the ancient world of the Mexica people.
Uh-huh.
And then they go on to describe the Taino people with whom Columbus first came in contact. And you know what his first thought was with them? These people are really nice, and they don't have weapons. Wow, we could enslave them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. By the way, I can vouch for that documentary, because part of that documentary was a talk to us to explain the contact or the situation or culture of Native American cultures. And so, you know, that's a very good documentary. Also, Dr. Bill had a very interesting program where he talked about the nature of what he felt objectivity was in the classroom, and I'll have to get in touch with him and have a discussion with him about his notions of objectivity. But it was interesting that he would mention that. He also mentioned editorial by Stanley Fish, who's a literary critic. And also, I'll send the 500 Nations link to dunk or send it off to somebody who can, you know, disseminate it so that people can, you know, have a link to that program.
Excellent. Thank you, Larry. Thank you very much.
You know, Bob, if I recommended that video to folks that I know and respect here in Syracuse,
yeah,
people that have an open mind and or think like I do and y'all do, they would tell me that they do not, absolutely do not have 6 hours to spend watching a YouTube video. But they will watch a doubleheader on Sunday leading up to the playoffs.
Oh, sure. Or they'll spend a hell of a lot more than 6 hours watching Pickers or Nasty Work or whatever it's called, or Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child or Duck Dynasty. Oh, my.
You know what? I one of my neighbors mentioned Duck Dynasty.
Oh, no.
I've been involved in the last couple of years with the exterior restoration of my 1920-something home. And as a part of my goal, I decided that I wasn't going to cut my hair nor shave until it was done. So I began to look like a 1960s radical, only grayed. And she told me that I looked like someone on Duck Dynasty, and I live a cable-free life. I will not buy TV that insists on then advertising to me. It's just a matter of principle. And so I had no idea what the hell she was talking about. And then she gave me the picture from the front of Parade magazine, and pointed out that one of the characters on this knucklehead program was someone that she said I looked like. I do not gravitate toward popular culture and mainstream thinking. And that's the beauty of what I described in my email message to you last night, is the network.
Yes.
I differentiated that from the horn or the family commune or the family, because I recently read, and this is kind of a takeoff, or it's an expression of what Jim got me going on maybe a year ago with on a Field of Red. Jim, you know about this?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I mailed back into the to Bob about this, but it was a fantastic book, assiduously researched. When I was an undergrad, I sought a double major in English and political science. But history has really grabbed me by listening to these programs over the last several years. And so that book launched me into a series of other historical books, including Susan Jacoby's efforts. Max Blumenthal's book about the religious right, these fundamentalists. Republican Gomorrah is the title of this book, and man, I've heard of that.
Puts
under two covers the whole pantheon of these freaks, so that you understand the connection between James Dobson and his family out in Colorado Springs and Tony Perkins. Focus on the family. No, I'm sorry. The Family Research Council.
Yep.
And their connection.
Because it's a huge spider web
wing from Focus on the Family.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the Left Behind series. A neighbor of mine. What I got to know her this past summer, and I asked her what she read, and she told me Tim LaHaye.
Oh dear God.
I immediately thought, oh God, what the hell have I introduced myself to here? So I told her, well, our friendship will be strained by the fact that I'm an atheist. And she just, you know, she had the typical predictable reaction to it all. But Max Blumenthal, this book, I don't know, it's under 400 pages, and it's very well researched, but when I get through it, as I head toward the end of a good book, I slow down my reading because I want it to last longer. And even if it's tough to get going, to get it started, I may open up the middle of the book and then create my interest and then go back to the beginning and then read the whole thing.
Well, you know what Francis Bacon said about books?
Yeah.
And, you know, as far as the field of read is concerned, if
yes.
you want another fairly good read, and I've just perused, not read it, but it's The War That Stopped the Peace, and it's basically dealing with the same situation in pre-Wilhelmine Germany.
Uh-huh.
It just came out. I have it on my reading table in the other room. I cannot even remember the author's name for a gander. I'm just
That's
having
okay.
a brain
That's okay, Jim.
But nonetheless, The War That Stopped the Peace, and it's a good read too.
Well, when I hear you and Bob discussing Roman history, when I was in grade school, my father told me that come high school I would be learning Latin, and I resisted the notion, but when I got to high school, he told me that it was going to happen, and it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that it would teach me to think. And my father was a practicing attorney, and I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. That's when I came of age. I was born in 53. And so in that era, I've told many, many people, younger than me and older than me, that it was a fantastic time to be a young person in America, because everything was being questioned. Authority was being questioned.
Oh, yeah.
Conventions were being questioned.
Yeah, but Dan, did they get their answers, and that's how we wind up with the 80s and 90s? And I'm not trying to be an ass here.
Well, Bob, I think the 80s taught us a great deal, and there's a lot to be gained from the 80s.
Bob, I think that what's happened is back then is what we've seen happen today. Okay, so Barack Obama, the alleged progressive, wins the 08 election, and everybody relaxes. I think people relaxed back then.
Is that kind of the way that everybody relaxed? Ah, we've beaten the monster when Nixon resigned?
Yeah, I think so, Bob. I think so. You know, we know that when I was a little boy in school, we were always taught that freedom isn't free. You have to be constantly vigilant, and you have to keep your guard up. Well, you know, the implicit enemy was the communists and the socialists and those guys, right? But we didn't realize that it was really the wealthy right here.
Just like the implicit enemy in toward the end of the second decade of the 20th century was the anarcho-syndicalists.
That's right. That's right.
And in every instance in this country, when we've been told who the implicit enemy was, it turned out it wasn't who they said it was. It turned out it was them. You know, it's all out
That's
of
right.
pogo. You know, it's all we have seen the enemy and they as us.
Exactly. A complete bullshit. And if you've ever, I've become a real, real, real big fan of Chris Hedges. I love, the guy died in 2010.
Howard Zinn?
I'm sorry?
Howard Zinn? No.
Howard Zinn, I love the guy, but I wasn't thinking of him. Chalmers Johnson.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, man, this guy was so onto it. And it was on a radio program on NPR when Anthony Zinni mentioned how many bases we had, foreign bases, measuring in the 700 to 1,000 range, and he did not include embassies. These were strictly military and secretive CIA and whatever else.
Yeah, black sites and
exactly. Now there are only a couple hundred countries on Earth, and the Russia and China are off the board. So think about the concentration of our bases in foreign countries, and what they do there. And what they do there is basically what Smedley Butler said.
Yeah.
They bully those countries, destroy their own local economies, so you and I can have cheap gas and cheap grapefruit and cheap pineapples and all the other
right. And so we can, and so in the dead and still of January, we can put white seedless grapes on boats in Chile, send them to the port of Los Angeles, and then put them on trucks and send them to Syracuse or Fayette County, West Virginia.
Exactly. And when I speak about these matters to people that are completely clueless, you know, I look at someone that would need a couple of college semesters to get up to speed on this shit. And it so annoys me that even in my own family, when I told my sister that who was that prick in Virginia that is the second in command in the house?
Eric Cantor. Yeah.
Cantor.
Leave Brittany alone.
Was demanding a fee for his little gatherings.
Yeah.
He was demanding some sort of fee to get into his little alleged town hall meetings.
Truly king of the pig people.
Huh?
Truly king of the pig people.
And that's right. It's exactly so. And my sister Paula said, "You got to be joking." I said, "Honey, don't listen. Don't watch NBC. Don't watch." And by the way, I'm from the Western New York area.
Yeah.
Where who was that guy who was a Buffalo Bills fan? Died a couple of years ago. Completely overrated. Tim Russert.
Oh.
Completely overrated as a journalist. When Dick Cheney sat in next to him and talked about, you know, we're going to go to the dark side, and he didn't challenge that. I thought.
Yeah, well, and you know, since you mentioned Tim Russert, Dan, we can also say that you know, the veil has been pulled back on the for-profit media by the fact that Tim Russert died suddenly, and lo and behold, suddenly his son had a job that people would crawl across ground glass to have at NBC with no credentials whatsoever, strictly, you know, strictly nepotistic, strictly hereditary.
Right.
I think you're plugged in. As the Horn family.
I tell you what, Bob. In my immediate neighborhood here in the east northeast little section of Syracuse that I reside in, I have a neighbor about 100 yards from me who was absolutely plugged in. And I call her my soulmate. But among my other neighbors, they are complete, they are like, zombies. They have no idea what's going on. Unless I tell them, look, go here, go there, educate yourselves. And that's her expression, my neighbor Diane. Educate yourselves.
Yeah.
It's out there.
Well, you know, that's right along the lines with something that Carol just wrote a little bit ago. She jumped in early. With Dr. John's challenge, and I sent her a note of thanks, and she says, "There's so much real news and truth available online. I hope they don't f with that." She said that it's criminal how the brilliant non-psychopaths in the media have to work so hard to get backing, but the psychopaths have clear sailing. And I think that's what you're touching on. She also said, "I love your callers, Jim and Bill, and the chicks that call. I learn so much from them, like getting another slice of life to experience. History and social commentary is excellent."
Yeah.
But
you know, Bob, I was going to say to Dan about the people that aren't tuned in. This culture doesn't give people the support and encouragement that they need to get tuned in. So therefore, people will follow the line of least resistance.
Well, there you go. It goes even beyond that, though. This culture encourages people not to be attuned to the body politic. And, you know, that's exactly whatever we can say, whatever negatives we might offer up about, you know, the slaveholding founders of this country, people like Jefferson predicated everything he said on an informed, educated, agrarian farmer republic, and this is the antithesis of all of that. You know, if Thomas Jefferson were alive, you think he'd be making the rounds of the Sunday shows, or do you think maybe he'd be doing a guest shot on Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child?
I don't think so, Bob. I mean, that's kind of way out there, but nonetheless, I understand where you're coming from. There's something I want to interject here before I have to leave, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I call this milestones. And, you know, during this year, 2013, we have lost a lot of wonderful people in the art, entertainment, and other things of that nature. I was watching number one on Turner Classic Movies. The actors and the people who contributed to films and things of that nature, which all of us have been moved by and seen. And also on, I always watch CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Osgood. And he also had a piece on that of the people that we've lost. I mean, everyone from, from Joan Fontaine to Lou Reed. I mean, they cover the whole gamut. And we've lost a lot of bright lights have been extinguished this year.
Well, they have, and I don't know how this is going to come off, Jim, but you look at a list like that, and you can think of all the contributions made by the people who have gone on, and then you say, yeah, and Dick Cheney is still walking around with some decent human being's heart beating in his chest.
I don't think about that at all.
Well, I do. You know, it's like that old joke about the guy who goes by the newsstand every day, buys a newspaper, looks at the front page, folds it back up perfectly, sets it on the stand, and walks along. This goes on for months, and the news guy finally says, "You know, you're paying me for a newspaper. Why don't you take it with you?" He says, "Nah, I'm looking to see if somebody died." And he goes, "Well, you don't even look at the obituaries." He goes, "No, this son of a bitch is going to be on the front page." And
I just don't think about people like him. I mean, I don't have time to think about people like him. I mean, the only time I've ever spent without Dick Cheney is when I coined the name or his pseudonym or what do you
Count Dickula.
Of Count Dickula.
That's one for the ages, Jim.
I mean, that's the only. I mean, I met the guy in person at Fort Jackson.
Ew. I didn't know. You never mentioned that.
I certainly did during Desert Storm. Yeah, I met him at a reception of the Officers Club. PAO, Public Affairs Officer, had made a comment about the placement of the unit in SWA in Southwest Asia, and Cheney can come down there to straighten some things out. And of course, for us to go, it was like a command performance of the O Club. And yeah, I met him, shook his hand, and it was like, you know.
Did you hold up a mirror or anything to see if he had a reflection?
You shook hands with Satan, Jim.
No, I didn't. I shook hands with a government official who was, he was basically, at that time, a member of my chain of command, and that's what I had to do, and...
This is before he was ever vice president, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
He was secretary of defense.
And one thing I will say this for Dick Cheney, I mean, he came from, where, Wyoming?
Via Texas, yeah.
And he brought with him Pete Williams. You remember Pete Williams, who was who's still on NBC, who was the voice of Desert Storm?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he was one of the first people that was outed by the Advocate. And Cheney stood by him. I remember that.
Outed.
He was gay. And
okay.
I even talked to Pete Williams on the phone and told him how much I appreciated his coverage and the efforts he had made to keep us well informed about a number of things, because Pete is a great journalist and he's a great reporter. But nonetheless, that guy was really put in a bad place by the Advocate when they did that to him, and they did it without his permission. But that's just my. I will say this, you know, Cheney basically did not squash him, and
it's the one good thing he did.
Yeah, but I mean that's just. You know, like I say, I met the man, not personally, but I met him in a receiving line, and that was it. That's not being a person, that's not a personal personal type of thing. I would have hated
No, that's before he generated the urge to shower in bleach among, you know, decent human beings.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think I would have cared to have worked for him, because I looked into the man's eyes and they were pretty cold and it was pretty ugly.
Well, you got to be pretty cold, Jim, to make a conscious decision to let somebody else go and get shot at in your place. You know, this is a man who had five deferments from Vietnam, and his final deferment he got by getting his wife pregnant.
Can I make a suggestion?
Jump in, Duncan.
Why don't we talk about people that points of light or whatever you want to call it that sprang forth in 2013?
All right, you
like
start.
First comes to my mind is Wendy Davis.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Read my mind, and I'm currently working for her.
Well, you're working on the side of the angels, Sergi.
Fantastic.
And then there's my other nominee was the name's on the tip of my tongue. The guy was Rush Limbaugh.
The woman that he trashed.
Yeah, Sandra Fluke. Yeah.
Andrew Fluke. Yeah.
Did she come back and hit him with a lawsuit?
I don't remember what
she did. I don't recall.
Several years ago, yeah.
She was made a victim on his program, but him calling her a slut and demanding that she post videos, it does seem to me that that would engender a legal response, but maybe not. But yeah, she was victimized by this bastard who exposed himself as being what he's always been.
The creature from the Black Lagoon.
Absolutely. What a crumb. What a human crumb this guy is.
Well, he's an asshole. He's just a gaping, bleeding asshole.
So he's not this kind of clown figure who's just doing this stuff for satire?
No,
he's an intensely
He's a malicious bastard.
He's a very mean-spirited person.
Okay.
And he just loves it. I mean, he would put Walter Winchell to shame. He would put Roy Cohn to shame, almost.
Well, he'd put Father Coughlin to shame.
Oh, that radio
Well, I've never heard Father Coughlin, but I don't think I want to.
No, you wouldn't. I never did either. But I'm about to parish used to talk about it.
And I know that Dunk wants to talk about positive lights of 2013, but before we go back to that, I wanted to ask about Cantor, because Cantor is, first of all, he's Jewish, and my assumption, and I'm making an assumption here, when Jews first came to this, you know, the first generation of American Jews that came to this country from Eastern Europe had a social justice conscience and frequently were involved in all kinds of political groups on the socialist or left, or at least they were intellectuals. And here you have Eric Cantor in Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley, and he's acting just like, a right-wing Republican of the John Birch variety. And I wanted to know what has changed in American history to create this kind of a situation.
Well, I think there's been an imposition, an insidious growth of money that these guys just find it extremely difficult to say no to. Money is it's a corrosive. When you've got when you've got a society, and I mentioned about 15 years ago to my father that it seemed to me at the time that the Republicans had purloined the national conversation. And I was referring to everything that everybody listened to and exposed themselves to on TV and radio, where these bastards were constantly, go back to the 90s, Clinton. You know, the Republicans felt that they had a right to the presidency, to the CEO's corner office of our country. And when Clinton upended Bush 1, he became the natural target for these bastards in Washington, in state's capitals, and of course wherever the money resided. And it was, and I remember thinking, back in the 90s, I was very, very involved with a beautiful woman, Jewish, and she and I just were, we shook our heads And we didn't understand at the time, late in his presidency, how right-wing Bibi Netanyahu was. But these guys, they've really seized the airwaves in ways that actually Clinton was instrumental in allowing. Sadly. And so with the concentration of media locally, you know, there isn't a prayer.
Well, I want to go back.
Said, Bob, many yeah. times that you said on your program, the ratio of and maybe it's Malloy, but the ratio of left wing minutes on air.
Yeah, left. Right, yeah, it's
is
stunning.
1,000 to 1.
1,000. There are 1,000 yeah. hours for every hour of progressive broadcasting.
I believe that absolutely.
Yeah.
One of my cars I bought from a guy in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I negotiated the deal and I went down there and I drove this thing back. And as I traveled through Mississippi and Tennessee and Kentucky and Southern Ohio, I was astounded by what I was listening to on AM radio. It was nauseating.
Oh, yeah, and it's not just the folks that everybody knows about. It's not just the Hannitys or the Limbaughs or
no,
whatever.
It's local guys.
Yeah, there are these local, I mean, I the same thing happened to me. It was right before we got back from the derecho 2 summers ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Driving through central, east central and west Mississippi and west central Alabama. I remember talking about listening to some right wing gas bag talking about how, what was it? The government was regulating taking away our freedoms because there had been some rule promulgated about access for the, mobility challenged to swimming pools. And I mean, I was reaching for my cell phone and I guess, you are not calling a talk radio program in West Central East Central Mississippi, Bob. You are not going to do it. I will make you stop this car and I will get out and walk. And I was going, but honey, no, you can go back to work when you get home. You're off the clock.
Thank goodness for Agnes.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, when he was saying this, I was thinking, wait a minute, let's take this back 40 years, and damn, we're still on the swimming pools, aren't we?
Yeah.
But I wanted to go back to something based on what you'd raised, and of course, I always welcome the conversation with everybody. Don't be so quiet. But I was I actually had lunch with Boss Man Wayne today, and we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, and he pointed out something that just floored me. He said, look at how the Affordable Care Act has been treated since it was passed. And to the extent that messes have been made, they've been made intentionally. He said, can you imagine if Koch Brothers money and all these other sleazy right-wingers, can you imagine what would have happened to Social Security under FDR? Had that money been available, they would have declared it a failure before the first check was delivered.
Yep.
Or think about, you know, the very first food stamp payment was made to an out-of-work coal miner in Appalachia.
A useless eater.
Yeah. What's his name? James, who's the asshat, makes the videos, got busted in New Orleans. Did the Acorn BS thing. Right winger.
Breitbart.
Worked for Breitbart.
James O'Keefe.
Thank you, Sergi. Maybe he could have been skulking around that miner's back window trying to find out if they were really hungry enough to deserve to eat on the government's dime. And so I think Wayne had a really, really profound point in that.
You know, things have gotten really hard over the past 20 years with these people. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
I think they're as mean as they've ever been, but they're just able now, Jim, to let their mean flag fly.
They've been empowered.
Well, you know, I mean, just a second. I was watching a program on the 80s, and they had Ryan White over there. A little boy who died with AIDS, he had contracted as a hemophiliac by using factor VIII. Remember him?
Yeah.
The one who drew so much attention, besides Rock Hudson, who really made it a real thing for people to understand. But Reagan, in 87, made a policy speech about AIDS, but nothing that was palliative or any way helpful to the people who were dying from it. But I will say this for Bush 1. He did sign into law the Ryan White Bill, which was the first federal program to help AIDS research, and also in conjunction with AMFAR and a number of other things founded by Elizabeth Taylor, who really brought a lot of compassion and understanding to people who were dying of a disease. And they even projected, you know, that this thing would not go away. It would still be with us. Whereas Reagan just completely ignored it. But at least Bush won.
Ronald Reagan, hey Jim, let me just press the pause button for a moment. Ronald Reagan was the guy who at mid or late 30s deflowered a young teenager in Hollywood, and he complained to her that she didn't climax and that he wasted 50 cents on a condom. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the same guy who some decades later became our chief executive.
It
proves what you're expressing about Bush 1 is nothing more than, you know, no person is all bad.
No, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that Bush 1 would not be even in these people today. Bush 1 would not even be in good company with, to tell you the truth.
No, you. Well,
I know.
Richard
that's
Nixon.
That's how bad it's become, Jim.
That's the point. I mean, even Richard Nixon would be denounced.
And the criminal Nixon would be right.
I mean, some of the people that, you know, like Nixon and other people who were right wing at their time, my God, and compared to some of the idiots they've got up there now, they've become so radical. I mean,
well, the John Birch Society in our time are the teabaggers. Now, back in the '50s, the John Birch Society members were not welcome in the Republican Party.
Mm-mm.
That's how messed up we've become.
No, they ran them out.
That's right.
Did you happen to see the article? I think it ran in Salon a few days ago about the repentant libertarian who had left libertarian politics and become a liberal.
It was
a fascinating insight into that because, you know, the John Birchers and the right wingers of the tea baggers, you know, they all pretty much kind of congregated under that libertarian umbrella for a very long time until they could bust out on the, you know, kind of like a, oh no, I'm not going to, people might be eating. But, you know, he tells this story about how.
After the show, Bob.
Very considerate, Bob.
Thank you. Yeah, I was raised right, you know. It's worth going and finding, you know, I was a libertarian, Salon, I was a libertarian, something like that. And he talks about the garden variety libertarian that you run across. And they're nasty, nasty people. I mean, I don't like just saying somebody's a nasty, but they are. You know, we got to get back to the gold standard. And, you know, those are the thinking libertarians. You know, if we could just get back to the gold standard and legalize marijuana, I think we could have freedom again.
You know, going back to our favorite ogre, and I don't know what bridge he lives under, Rush Limbaugh, and what he had to say about Pope Francis.
Yeah.
And now there's a big hullabaloo in New York because there are certain wealthy Catholics, and there's one in particular. I mean, one guy is the head of Home Depot. And he had some problems with the Pope's remarks. And then there's another guy who is supposed to contribute $7 million to the renovation of St. Patrick's Cathedral, who is not pleased with His Holiness either. And so, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, what Pope Francis said as far as wealth and this type of thing is concerned was a very bright light coming from Rome. And yet you have these people here who are even challenging his authority.
Well, sure, you know, they'll challenge the duly elected president of the United States. They'll challenge a pope. By the same token, I did see something a couple of days ago about the pope, Jim. He's gotten a lot of good press for his live and let live attitude towards gay folks. But he is still, just in case anybody is wondering, he is still very much supportive of efforts to prevent gay couples from ever being able to adopt. So, you know, there's not that much change going on.
Well, you know, you can't go, one man can only do so much. I mean, you can't expect a complete vote fire or about face. But, you know, I think the man's heart is in the right place. And I think he's a very positive influence upon the world. And I applaud him for his ability and his candor in making those comments that he made that were so decried by our friend Mr. Limbaugh, troll extraordinaire, who called him a Marxist.
I
just wondered if Rush were to ever get into sunlight, would he turn to stone?
Well, did you know, Jim, that Franklin Graham has now condemned the Pope?
Oh, I don't doubt that.
You know, son of Billy.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Can you send me Franklin Graham's credentials so I can review them? Who is this? Who
that
is
would
this
be
Frank?
A blank page.
Come on. Who is this guy? And who was his old man?
Yeah, right.
You know, a big blowhard that had enough. That had,
well, you know, every time I think of Billy, I think of Richard Nixon sitting there in the Oval Office.
Absolutely.
You know, Billy, the problem with this country is the Jews
it's
in
the
Hollywood.
Jews.
Absolutely,
it's
Mr.
Jews.
President. You know, but I just real quick, I found the article over at Salon. It's called "Why I Fled Libertarianism and Became a Liberal." There's some really choice stuff in here. It's by a guy named Edwin Linger, and he's from Nevada. And he talks about the meeting of the 2008 Nevada Republican Convention, where the Ron Paul delegates all get together at Reno High School.
Excuse me.
Yeah, he writes during the meeting, a Ron Paul staffer, a smart and charismatic young woman, gave a tip to the group for the upcoming Republican convention. Dress normal, she said. Wear suits and don't bring signs or flags. Don't talk about conspiracy theories, just fit in. And he writes, her advice was the kind you might hear given to an insane uncle at Thanksgiving. Then the next day I ran into that same operative at the convention and I complimented her because Ron Paul delegates were being accepted into the crowd. I added, we're going to win this thing. Bring in the clowns, she said, and smiled before I lost her in the mass of people.
Bob, which one was the one who appeared in Bruno?
Oh, that was Ron Paul. That was Ron Paul.
Bob, were
how
were
the in the world did they get him into that? I mean, could he not realize that he was being taken straight into?
Oh, he's just a simple little bigot. You know, just a small town Texas country doctor. He said, this guy writes on, and there was another,
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
No, that's okay. That's worth looking up. You know, just Ron Paul Bruno. You won't be okay.
Oh.
You know.
Are you disparaging his asparagus?
I am casting aspersions on his asparagus. I am.
Bob, were the Austrian economists that came up with the libertarian or developed the libertarian philosophy, were they as simple-minded and as knuckle-dragging as these libertarians that we're talking about today on the program?
Well, I mean, they were thinking about economics in sort of high-flown theoretical terms. There's an old joke out there about an engineer, about a civil engineer and a mechanical engineer, and an economist trapped on a desert island. And they've got all these cans of food, but no way to open it. So the mechanical engineer designs a machine that will drop a big rock on the can and open the can, but then all the food splatters out all over the place and there's still nothing to eat. So the civil engineer uses the power of fire to burst the cans, but again, the can blows up and there's no food to eat. So then they turn to the economist and they say, well, what about you? How do you think we can get these things open and eat the food? And he said, assume a corkscrew, or assume a can opener. God, I blew the punchline. Assume a can opener. And that's, you know, that's the way these highfalutin theorists operate. You know, because we're just going to assume that everybody's going to be okay and the flat tax is going to work and the bridges aren't going to crumble and the roads aren't going to revert to gravel and the garbage bags aren't going to pile up on the side of the road. You know, just assume that that's all going to be okay and then everybody's just going to be free and we're going to live on the gold standard.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Flat tax.
Fuck
an me. Attempt to treat unequal people equally. That should at least get.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you heard last night, but Ron and Raleigh wrote in about the fact that North Carolina Stan has passed a state level flat tax.
Yeah.
And they hired the same folks that effed up the Obamacare website.
Of course.
CGI.
Yeah. There's a biblical passage somewhere, probably in the Old Testament, that says, from those that have been given the most, much will be expected, or the most will be expected.
Well,
so,
that is in there.
You know, the whole notion of flat tax to me is you have to throw that back into their face.
Well, there's no such thing as a flat tax.
Here's the example: you have two or three cars rolling into a state park or a federal park, and the fee for entry is $8 a car. For a couple, and maybe a buck ahead for every individual beyond that. Okay, so you got a guy with a family. He drives in with an 85 Honda, and he's assessed whatever he's assessed, and then the guy behind him drives in with a Maybach. And it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He is assessed the same darn entrance fee, and so that is an example. A fee is a flat tax.
Yeah,
flat tax is a regressive tax.
Of course it is.
But this is the language that we need to seize back from these pricks that have seized our conversation.
Right. Well, it's regret. I mean, and see that you're exactly right. You've described it better than I ever could, because my impulse, Dan, is to say, oh, you know, a flat tax is by definition regressive, because if everybody's paying the same thing, then everybody isn't paying the same thing, because the tax lands more heavily on some than on others.
Absolutely.
Which is exactly why you have progressive taxation, which is what North Carolina has eliminated.
How in the world can they do that? I mean, you know, how can they, if I may ask, how can they eliminate or play with federal tax codes?
Well, no, North Carolina, in this case, it was their state tax code. Now, I mean, you know, people like Rand Paul and Ron Paul and probably Ted Cruz, you know, they want a federal flat tax. Because, you know, one of the essential platform planks of the Libertarian Party, and behind them, the John Birchers, has, I mean, if they could set off a bomb under the IRS, they would.
But what I'm saying is this. Aren't, to a certain degree, state tax codes and federal tax codes meant to coalesce with one another and follow the same pattern?
They don't have to, though.
In the spirit of the law?
They don't have to.
There's a big variance, Jim.
I mean, there are states that have no income tax at all.
Their state taxes are very high.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. They are. And
for instance, I mean, for instance, in a state like Florida, Stan, you've got state income taxes largely gutted, but the revenue's got to come from somewhere, so they call them fees. And I mean, you've got to pay a fee for this and a fee for that, and it's brutal.
Yeah, it is.
And interestingly, they've also reinstituted debtor's prison in places like Florida and Alabama.
A fee is a regressive tax.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the fee falls upon those who are, in the very least, able to pay it.
Sure.
That's the thing about these fees.
That's the point.
Here in Texas, they quote unquote make up for the lack of a state income tax mainly through property taxes.
Yeah. And wait until you go to try to register a deed after you purchase some property.
Oh boy.
You know, the tax stamps on the deed can be crippling.
Oh yeah.
There's an abundance of all of that, and that's the dodge. Look, we lowered your taxes. No, you didn't.
No, you didn't. You just transferred them to somebody else who could not afford to pay them.
Right, or actually, you raised them.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they just transferred from one class to the other, and they've increased the tax burden. People say, "Oh no, we have lowered your taxes." No, you haven't.
No,
well,
and see,
transfer it to somebody, other poor bastard, who really cannot afford to pay them when you should be under a more aggressive and graduated income tax.
Well, Jack in Shreveport just wrote in and said, progressive taxation. I don't hear mentioned that progressive taxation is fair. Each dollar that is taxed within each bracket is taxed at the same rate regardless of total income, I think. And that's essentially how it works.
Wait a minute! Whoa! The fairness is involved in the folks that are wealthy have generated their wealth through greater use of the commons.
Right.
The commons. Okay.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go back to something that I mentioned earlier on when I took my trip down to Louisiana. To bring back to the salty city of Syracuse, New York, the guy that I bought the car from, I asked him because Louisiana schools were 47, 48, 49, 50 in the nation's schools, and I asked him, I said, how are schools funded here? And he said, well, real estate taxes. I said, well, okay, so tell me about that. And he told me that. At the time, now this is 2000, he said, well, real estate taxes are capped at $70,000. I think that's correct. My memory may be off, but $70,000 so that nobody can be taxed at for his property at a rate that exceeds $70,000. So if a guy has $1 million property, he's paying real estate taxes at a $70,000 property tax rate.
Yeah. And which is kind of like the Social Security cap, which is BS.
Well, but yes, of course. Yeah, right. In another really annoying fact of American life. But it does explain why Louisiana's schools are so ill-funded. And I mentioned this. I said, how does this get by the voters and the legislature? And he said, you know what? Nobody that has any real value in their property wants to be taxed at a higher rate, and they don't give a damn about the next generation.
That's
the reality.
And also look at the schools and the public schools of where they are now, and there's a method to madness too, because there's a tremendous effort to transition from public education for lack of funding and also other,
of course,
other arcane desires to put them into these charter schools and things of that nature.
And Jim, explain that to someone who would tune into Honey Boo Boo.
Oh.
Oh, sweetheart, I could not even deal with Honey Boo Boo. I saw her one time.
But you get my point.
I do, and your point is well taken, straight right in my rear end. Honestly and truly, your arrow found its mark. Honey Boo Boo Child, my God, I just saw that fool's going to be renewed, and those horrible people are going to be up there.
Which kind of, if you don't mind me jumping in, I just want to share this real quick because it's kind of important. Because Dan, you mentioned Louisiana, we brought in Honey Boo Boo Child, and of course, well. I want to get out there that when we've talked about Duck Dynasty, I'm not talking about the the celebrity quality of it. I'm talking about the, as social phenomenon that indicates something much deeper and darker underlying, kind of what I said at the beginning of the program about how, you know, I think we're going to see this white reactionism coming in 2014. It's just going to get nastier. So there's a guy who writes for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and his name is Robert Mann, and he writes on politics, Louisiana, and life.
Uh-huh.
And he received a letter from an anonymous writer that said, Bob Mann recently wrote a post from the perspective of a young lesbian girl that really painted an accurate picture of LGBTQ life in Wichita Parish, but I couldn't share it on my Facebook. It was too gay. It's fine for you to stand up for the queers, my grandparents will say, but God help you if you're one of them. I am, it appears to be, he writes, the last gay man still in the closet to his family. That's why this post is anonymous. That's why my sexual orientation is blank on Facebook. That's why I use gender-neutral pronouns when talking about my significant other. I can't be gay in Northeast Louisiana. I came out to my parents and they've shoved me back into the closet. The family isn't ready to hear that, they said. The family isn't ready. Well, I suppose in all fairness it did take some getting used to myself. I live in West Monroe, and I'm a mass communication student at the University of Louisiana at Monroe. I moved here because it's more progressive than my hometown, also in Northeast Louisiana. I mean, it has two gay bars. Look out, San Francisco. But West Monroe is also home to the most famous anti-gay person in the world, Phil Robertson. I've never met Phil, but I was raised by a Phil Robertson. My Phil Robertson told me that I was an asshole for being so selfish to come out of the closet to my mother. My Phil Robertson told me that my boyfriend will never be welcomed at his house as if he were diseased. My Phil Robertson threatened my life because I had the audacity to be who I am. I'm 21 now. I first realized I was gay when I was 13. I've known that I liked boys since I was 8, and I will never forget the day that I decided I wasn't going to be gay. I was in Sunday school, and I'd been daydreaming about moving off to San Francisco because my dad had told me it was full of faggots. It sounded like the place for me. Then it came to be my turn to read the Bible, and I read the verse aloud. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. That didn't quite click with me, so I asked what it meant. And my Sunday school teacher said, it means that being gay is a sin. I felt sick. It was fine if my dad hated gays, but now God does too. My future caved in around dreams of sunny California and San Francisco, until all I could see were the fires in the pit of hell. I was 13 years old. So I became straight because I didn't want to go to hell. And any time I strayed from the path of heterosexuality, I prayed to God to heal me of my sickness. And then after a while, I still liked boys. So I prayed harder. I prayed more. I cried. Until eventually I stopped believing in God altogether. If there was a God, surely he heard my prayers. So he is either wanting me to be the sinner I am, or he doesn't exist. Either way, it's not a God I wish to believe in. I was 16 when I lost my faith. I was also 16 when I met my first boyfriend. It was like being James Bond in Podunk, Louisiana. We'd sneak off to the soybean fields just so we could be together. It was all a magical experience of holding hands under blankets and secret signals for I love you. To be 16 again. I had my first kiss, my first time, and my first heartbreak. I was being the most abnormal person in school, but I was finally living what I thought was a normal life. I was being me, even though me involved leading a double life. And so he goes on and he says, one year it was Chick-fil-A. This year it's Phil Robertson. Thanks to Phil, I now know where everyone in my family stands on the issue of whether or not I'm a human being. I even saw a friend of mine post something about how gay people can't be Christians. Wow, not only will they keep us from having equal rights, but they'll keep us from equal salvation. We can't just be second-class citizens. We have second-class souls. And you know, it's a long letter. You can find it at Bob Mann, B-O-B-M-A-N-N, blog.com. But I read that and was just absolutely floored, because the fact of the matter is, it ain't Phil Robertson. It's a whole country full of Phil Robertsons. I was walking out of the grocery store today, because I'd gone to get my corned beef and cabbage, minding my own business, learning to keep my mouth shut here and there, and I see this woman, and she's not wealthy. She's probably not even, I mean, she's probably just bad off. Hair in disarray. Slovenly.
Mm-hmm.
What's she wearing? On New Year's Eve for a trip to the grocery store down to Fayetteville.
One can only imagine.
It's a T-shirt. and it says Duck Dynasty Forever.
You know, Bob, speaking
of course.
You know, excuse me, gentlemen. Before I went to work for the federal government, I had to have I taught school and had to have a parent-teacher conference with the principal about a real bad student, and his mother wore this T-shirt. It was like three times too small, and on the front of that T-shirt was, "I can't believe I ate the whole thing." And I just looked at her and thought to her and thought to myself, honey, you might not believe it, but you sure as hell ate something.
But the rest of us do. Yeah, and see that, what, you know.
And the reason we were having the parent-teacher conference was because she had bought her son a T-shirt with two feces walking together saying, "Get your shit together." And I threw the guy out of class. I said, "You're not going to wear that in my classroom." I said, "You can either go home, you can use shirts and skins, do what you want to do, but you're not going to wear that in my class."
And it required a meeting. Bless my soul.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I tell you what, with just a few minutes remaining that we have here, let me bring another call on real quick. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hey, Edward.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I just want to tell you, I talked to some friends of mine in Kansas City, and they're having a rather big celebration there at this particular place. It's very popular in Kansas City, this area, and they have been advertised to come to the New Year's Eve and bring their guns. And at the stroke of midnight, they will all point their guns up in the air and shoot them.
Oh, Jesus. Well, I was going to mention that. Come about midnight here, out here in the wilds of wild, wonderful West Virginia.
Yes.
It's going to be like downtown Baghdad at midnight.
Well, Bob, I don't think evidently so. It's going to be the same way in Kansas City.
Jesus God.
Bob, may I say something real quick?
Yeah, jump in.
Over in one of the Emirates, I think not Dubai, but one of the others, they are spending $500 million on fireworks tonight.
Hallelujah.
Well, at least those things don't fall back to Earth at something approaching their original muzzle velocity, Jim.
Well, see, finally, the law here in Dallas has finally stopped people from doing that, because when they go up, they come back down, and you know what happens if one of those bullets hits you on the head? It splits your skull open.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
People know that it's the only day they can get away with it.
Yeah. I'd like to jump in here just real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, regarding Ferg and the draft, I'm a member of the local draft board here in Humboldt County, and they're not doing any training anymore because they've run out of money. But so other people may want to get appointed to the draft board, too. Check out your local draft board, see if they have a vacancy, because it's more fun than not being on it. Anyhow, we're not meeting, we're not doing anything. But if you want to get a CO, it is absolutely imperative to have a documented history of that kind of activity prior to your getting your draft notice. There's no plan for a draft right now or anything else. So Ferg needs to have some paperwork documentation that he has been active in a conscientious objector kind of status.
Would a front page photograph of him at the age of five sitting at an anti-Iraq war rally be a start?
That would be a great start.
It's there.
Well, I
because
I have
it shows
a
familial history. You no longer have to have a belief in a supreme being, but being a universal life minister won't cut it.
Okay. Edward?
Could I say something?
Yes.
Oh, dear. Well, I just think I had a senior moment.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry. Minute,
boop, but it does that every now and then. It'll come back, but after you've hung up. I enjoy the program very much. Enjoy listening to you every evening.
Well, thank you, Edward. Thank you very much.
Yes. Yep. You mean a lot to a lot of people.
That's beautiful to hear. Thank you, Edward. Thank you.
Hey, Bob.
Well, happy New Year.
Bob and the group.
All right.
This is Dan. I just want to thank you guys for letting me unload a little bit tonight, because it's been building up. And
Dan, I've enjoyed your conversation tremendously.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Dan. And I hope this will not be the last.
And this will be, now that I've broken the ice, you can count on me being a regular caller.
And live to tell the tale. You know, that's important.
Hey, good luck with your house.
Well, thanks very much, Jim. It's, you know, the closer it gets to completion, the more gratifying it becomes. It was a major emotional struggle starting out, and I did things that were out of order just because I needed to see the result.
Well, I tell you what, stand by. I want to bring one more person on here for a very good reason. Now, what's going to happen here is, in a minute, we are going to be overridden by Rick Smith jumping onto the stream. But I just brought a final caller onto the line, and I want to make sure before we're out of here, because this will appear on the podcast, okay?
Okay.
I want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to say whatever it is that's on their mind. Hi, who did I just bring on?
Perhaps it's me.
I think it's you. Who have I got?
Oh, this is Roger in Minneapolis.
Oh, hey, Roger. How are you?
Dipping my toe in for the first time to the major Shark Tank here.
No sharks here. We are all the most pacifist of guppies.
Yes. Well,
plus we got the shark alert system that Bob was talking about.
That's true.
I thought I'd come swim with the guppies a little and say hi to some of the people that I've been enjoying their insights for quite some time.
Hello.
This is my first time to actually say hi to Jim, for example.
Yep, I think you just did.
Good.
Jim, Roger, Jim.
Roger that.
Oh, clever.
A quick note.
Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
Quick note regarding the origins, or what was going on in Austrian thought around economics, and you may be somewhat more informed in some areas there than I, but I spent 15 years working with a professor of economics at the University of Minnesota, translating German and Austrian economic thought into English for the first time.